Good morning and welcome. My name is Vicki Rideout. I'm a vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm the director of our program for the study of media and health. And thank you all for joining us here today for our forum on anticipating children's media policies in the Obama era. This forum today is a joint project between the Kaiser Family Foundation and the American Center for Children and Media. And I want to take a minute to thank the president of the ACCM, David Kleeman, for having come up with the idea for this forum in the first place and for all of the hard work he put into making it happen. So thank you, David. And you'll be hearing from David shortly. I think we have probably all been hearing and reading a lot lately about how all the experts expect communications policy to unfold under the new administration. What impact is it going to have on telecom companies, on cable, on venture capitalists, on new media companies? How will Google and Yahoo fare versus AT&T and Verizon? How will Comcast fare versus NBC or CBS? Well, today we want to stop and take just a minute to consider how the new telecom policy landscape in Washington will affect another important group, children. Violence in the media, sex in the media, media ratings, video games, online safety, indecency, educational television, media literacy, public broadcasting, public interest obligations, food advertising to children, privacy, interactive advertising to children. Just what do the changes in Congress, at the FCC, at the FTC, and in the White House mean for these issues? That's what we're here to talk about today. We're not here to have a debate about the pros and cons of any of the policy options in any of these issue areas. We're not here to advocate for or oppose adoption of any new policies in any of these realms, really. But we do think that the impact of media policies on children is just as important and just as deserving of attention as the impact of media policies on the telecom industry, the cable industry, the broadcast industry, and so on. And that's why we're here. And it is indeed a very different policy landscape on communications policy issues in Washington today than it was just a few months ago. On Capitol Hill, the chairmanship of two key committees has shifted hands. In the Senate, there's a new chair of the Commerce Committee who is somebody who has shown a willingness to pursue regulatory policies when it comes to children and media issues. Also in the Senate, another senator who's been a longtime leader on children's media issues has left the Senate altogether for the State Department. What impact will that have? In the House, the chair of the Telecommunications Subcommittee, somebody who has been a longtime leader on children's media issues, has shifted to become chair of a different committee and has been replaced by somebody who doesn't really have a lot of history on children's media policy issues. At the FCC, we've got a new acting chair, who's somebody who's been very passionately involved in kids' media issues. We're all expecting a new permanent chair, somebody who's a little bit of a Rorschach test for media insiders. He's variously described as a consumer watchdog and the ultimate industry insider. So we're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. We're expecting a new chair at the FTC as well. And in the White House, of course, we've got a new president who has two young children and who actually lives the issues that we're talking about here today on a daily basis. And he's somebody who has expressed very strong concern about media's impact on children and very strong respect for and belief in the First Amendment. So how does all of this play out? Well, that's what we're going to talk about and try to tease out in our discussion here today. Before we get to that somewhat daunting task, it's my pleasure to introduce you to the co-sponsor of today's event, the president of the American Center for Children and Media, a longtime advocate for the concerns of children's media producers and for excellence in children's media, my colleague and friend David Kleeman.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming today. And before anything else in this Mutual Admiration Society, I want to thank Vicki and the Kaiser Family Foundation for co-producing and supporting this event. we've worked with Kaiser two times now, and they always live up to their reputation for seeking practical, forward-looking strategies to use media to promote health and well-being. And Vicky in particular brings a rigor and a thoughtfulness to all the events that she plans that demands the best out of everyone involved, from co-producer to panelists. This event is something of a departure, actually, for the American Center for Children and Media. We don't often insert ourselves into policy discussions. We're not an advocacy group, and we're industry guided. So it really only makes sense for us to do so when we feel we can bring a unique perspective or a fresh set of options in ways that establish dialogue rather than fostering argument. And this is one of those times, I think. We've created an agenda and a structure for today that will make this a productive, forward-looking day, whether you're an industry executive, an activist, a regulator, a legislator, a researcher, an analyst, or a content creator. Our goal for today is to help you develop realistic strategies and goals for the next 2 years. Now, my friends in the audience today know that I can get very boring about my hobby and my passion, which is distance running. But it's the mind of a marathoner that led me to come up with the concept for today's event. The more you know about the course that you're about to run, the better you can plan your strategy. The better you plan your strategy, the more control you have over your race, and I can tell you from painful experience, the more you retain control, the fewer surprises lie ahead. Information is power, and even if you don't like what you hear, it's far better to know what's coming than not to know. The best way to learn about a course that you're about to run is to ask people who've run it before, but with an historic president, and as Vicky was pointing out, new people virtually everywhere, no one's been down this exact path before. We have, however, gathered a remarkable, diverse, distinguished, articulate panel of experts who have either worked alongside the new children's media power brokers or have studied their track records and their past statements. I'm going to introduce them to you very briefly now, just name, title, and organization, and point out that while each has expertise in particular areas, we're not going to subdivide the group or limit their contributions to a particular topic. They're all going to remain at our horseshoe table here throughout, welcome to chime in on any topic. We've asked three of our colleagues to be framers, to give a quick overview of the status quo in our three topic areas. And they're in the front row here. Let me introduce Angela Campbell, professor of law and director of the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown Law. She'll be giving us the landscape for monitoring content. Amy Jordan, director of the Media and the Developing Child Program at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, who will be discussing encouraging excellence. And Patty Miller, vice president of public policy for Sesame Workshop, who will lay the foundation for considering commercialism. And they, too, are welcome to project forward when they are joined by our panel here. Stephen Balcom, and we've put them very kindly in alphabetical order to help me with my task here. Stephen Balcom, founder and CEO of the Family Online Safety Institute. Sandy Calvert, chair and professor in the Department of Psychology and director of the Children's Digital Media Center at Georgetown University. Colin Kroll, telecommunications policy analyst in the office of U.S. Representative Edward Markey. Dale Kunkel, professor of communication at the University of Arizona. Rob Lippincott, senior vice president of education at the Public Broadcasting Service. Jill Luckett, senior vice president, program network policy at the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Jeff McIntyre, director of national policy for Children Now. Mary Beth Murphy, chief of the policy division at the FCC Media Bureau. Alan Simpson, director of policy for Common Sense Media. Richard Taylor, senior vice president of communications and industry affairs at the Entertainment Software Association. Dennis Wharton, executive vice president, media relations at the National Association of Broadcasters. And Tim Winter, president of the Parents Television Council. And to paraphrase, never has such a distinguished group of children's media experts been assembled since Fred Rogers dined alone. I mentioned earlier that our intent is to send you home with information that will help you develop goals and strategies in the coming 2 years. We readily acknowledge that in this room there are widely divergent interests whose goals will not just vary, but are often going to come into conflict in the next 2 years. And that's why we've asked our panelists, and we'll ask you when you speak from the audience as well, to focus on what you believe will happen. If we get sidetracked by shoulds or wants, then we run the risk of this session devolving into polarization and argument, as too often, I think, happens with children's media conferences. We've also asked panelists, to, where possible, to back up forecasts with their reasoning, to show their work, as my daughter's math teacher would say. What past statements or actions by the people now in charge lead you to the projections that you're making, or what aspects of the current environment, political, media, economic, or social, make this an auspicious time for the developments that you're predicting? I really believe that everyone in this room is trying to do great things for kids. We may disagree at times about what kids need, what they deserve, or what they delight in, but children's media are not going away, so we need to develop sustainable strategies for ensuring that kids get our best work across the growing array of technology. The American Center has a three-word summary of its goals: anticipate, analyze, act. Today is an anticipate day. I'll be listening with the same purpose as you for insights to take home so that I can analyze, so that in the next 2 years, the Center and all of you can act in timely, thoughtful, and productive ways. Welcome and enjoy, and let me bring Vicky back to the podium.
Okay, so the first topic on our agenda today is monitoring content. And before we get to the panel discussion on that, we're fortunate enough to be able to hear a few words from somebody who has been a real leader on the issue of children's media as well as other children's policies, Senator Mark Pryor from Arkansas. He serves on the Appropriations Committee as well as the Commerce Committee, both places where he's able to have an impact on children's media policy issues. He's been a leader on the issue of broadband, in particular bringing broadband to rural areas. And most relevant for us, he is the author of legislation that just passed last December called the Child Safe Viewing Act. And I believe that the FCC will be issuing a notice of inquiry on that act next week, talking about media ratings policies that we have in place now and where we need to go from here. So please join me in welcoming Senator Mark Pryor.
Well, thank you, and I will try to focus on the will, as we said a minute ago, about what will happen this time. Of course, Senator Rockefeller is chairman of the Commerce Committee, and as you all know, and many of you all dealt with Jay Rockefeller for years, he is very focused on violence on television, very concerned about that. Some of my emphasis has been more with the sexual content on television and elsewhere. So I guess you can say he's violence and I'm sex. but really, I think that Senator Rockefeller wants to have a very active Commerce Committee this Congress. He sort of alerted all of the members of the committee and the chairman of the subcommittees that he wants to be very active. He wants the Commerce Committee to be one of the most productive committees in the Senate this Congress. So whether that's good or bad for this group, I don't know. I mean, again, you mentioned the diversity of viewpoints here. For some people, that may be great, and for others, it may not be so great. But I just want to let you know that that's what he's talking about. Obviously, when we're talking about content, we have to be very concerned about the constitutionality of issues, and that's something that we have to look very closely at. But also, one of the things that I really believe strongly in is that we need to give parents a lot of control in the content that their children have access to. And I know traditionally we've really focused on television, and television obviously is a very, very powerful medium. Both of my kids love to watch TV, and we have, cable at our house. We probably have, 150 maybe channels. I mean, I don't know how many, but, you know, some of those we restrict through the parental controls through our cable provider. And I think that's, I don't know, but I think that's probably the best way to do it. It's just give the parents more control, and that's one of the reasons we did the Child Safe Viewing Act, and I think it was the very last law that passed last year. I mean, literally the very last one that came out of both houses and the president signed. But, you know, the goal there is to allow the FCC to look at new technology today. Back when the V-chip came out, the V-chip was kind of the thing. It was great, cutting-edge stuff, and in today's world, there may be things that work a lot better. Let's let the FCC look at that. Let's let them figure out what's out there and what's possible. And the other thing that I really have a concern about as a parent is I have a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old, and I'm very concerned about the Internet. And I know, again, that there'll be some in this group that join me in that concern. Others are very, very reluctant to restrain any sort of content on the Internet. But it just concerns me, especially given the fact that the Internet is just, if possible, even is becoming more and more pervasive. Now, pretty much every cell phone you get, you know, pretty much has Internet access. And I think that part of what we need to be considering is looking at ways that we can restrict content here as well, because we like our children to have cell phones. I mean, it's great to be connected. We know where they are, the safety issues, you know, all the good things about having a cell phone with your children, the texting and all that. And the, Jill and I, we do the texting with our kids, and we keep up with them that way. But the downside is that if you're not careful, they'll have totally unrestricted access to the Internet. And there's just going to be some really bad things. Again, whether it's, you know, whatever category of bad thing you may be talking about. But I think it would be great if we could work on ways to allow parents to restrict that content as well. And again, I may be stepping on some toes here, but that's why I'm here, is to, you know, put that out on the table and talk about it. And let you know that that's something that I would like to consider, that I will be working on this Congress. I'd like for the Commerce Committee to consider various options on that. We'll probably be having some hearings. I mean, we don't know yet. Senator Rockefeller has not really laid out the sequence of how he wants things to go, but he knows I'm interested in that, and I know he's interested in the violence part as well. So we'll continue to work together. And with that, that's really all I had to say. And did you want me to take questions, or tell me which I need to?
If you have time, sure, to take one or two questions from the audience. We've got folks back there with microphones if anybody has a question for the senator.
Yeah.
Good morning, Senator Ira Sokowitz with the Ready to Learn Partnership. In reading the stimulus bill, sir, there's considerable money for rural broadband, and there's considerable money for school construction. Will the Senate and the House, now that the bill's been passed and a conference report written, will there be further instruction either through Ag or the Department of Ed to ensure that some of the construction that goes on builds smart schools, media capable, with the necessary wiring and or screens in them?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. You know, we had this happen in our state a few years ago where through a long series of decisions with the State Public Service Commission, one of the telephone companies had to put fiber optic cable to so many feet within a certain school buildings. And, you know, that's part of the settlement, and they had to do it. The problem is that the school districts didn't have any money to go from their school to the fiber optic system. And I think it's important that as we pass legislation and as we are thinking about the infrastructure that needs to be out there, that we make sure all the dots get connected, that nothing gets left out, and that we do that. And so I hope that what you'll find is, as this is implemented, there will be more and more direction on specifically how the money will be used. And as you know as well as I do, President Obama is very tech-savvy and really believes that that's the future of the country. And so, you know, his heart's there, and I think a lot of folks in Congress are there too. So we're going to try to make sure we get that done. And, you know, at this point, as you mentioned, there's a lot of rules that have to be written and implementation that has to be done. And, you know, certainly we'll encourage the administration as they're doing that to make sure that the money's spent well.
I actually have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
The Child Safe Viewing Act, you ask the FCC to give you a report about media ratings, not just on television, but across some other media as well. And some folks have said, and I'm going to quote somebody who commented on this, that it potentially opens the door to the beginning of convergence era content regulation at the FCC. What are your thoughts about the notion of having the FCC talk about Internet content, cable content, and so on?
I actually think that's okay. That's where I am. I think it's okay for the FCC to look at that and treat internet content the way it would, maybe not in exactly the same way, but in ways like it would treat television content. The truth is that the whole world is changing. It's changing all around us all the time. And the days of the traditional telephone line, that's pretty much gone. The days of the traditional television set, that's gone. I mean, you know, when I grew up, I tell my kids, they don't believe me, but we had three networks growing up. That was it. And there's just so much more available now. And I think it's great. I mean, it really is great. And this last week, my daughter was doing a paper for Black History Month, and she chose Morgan Freeman. And, you know, in today's world, back in the old days, I could have gone down to the library, and we found two books at the library on Morgan Freeman. That's it. But she had to have five sources. We found dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of sources on Morgan Freeman online. A lot of them are magazine articles and things like that. But it's so good and so positive. But then again, I think in the terms of content, you don't want it to be just like the Wild West out there. I think there is a role for government there. And again, I'm very sensitive to the First Amendment and the constitutional considerations there. But I think that it's at least worth talking about having the FCC look at this, see what is workable, what they can do. We have this challenge now where content doesn't all originate here in this country or from, like in the old days, mostly from New York and L.A. That's pretty much where most of it came from. Today it comes from all over the world. And it comes from all kinds, millions and millions of people. You go to Facebook or something like that, there's tens of millions of people out there using that every day. And that's all content. And so I don't pretend to have the expertise to know how that should be done or what in the end should be done, but I think the FCC, from my standpoint, should at least look at it, get that on the table, get that on the agenda, see what makes sense, how we would do that, what that might look like, and, you know, see if we should implement something. That's okay. The way I feel.
I know that you have a very tight timeline, but maybe time for one more quick question?
Sure.
Okay, staff is grimacing. Quick. Yes.
You're so talking to my passion. I arrived on the planet as the beginner of Reading Rainbow. I'm now a professor in Manhattan, Marymount, Manhattan. And one of the things I try to tell my students are to help kids understand media literacy, because we can put all the safeguards on, like, forever, and the kids will outsmart you every time. But if you can help them understand how to get through the stuff, you know, the media garbage, and get smarter, it seems to me putting rules in place, I mean, it makes a lot of good sense. But what makes me a little bit crazy is that you can put all the safeguards you want on, and you still have to have the kids understand that they have to figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. Right? Send your comments on media literacy.
You know, last night when, I don't know if y'all saw Obama's speech last night before the joint session, but one of the real differences in, say, a year ago, when President Bush gave his last State of the Union compared to last night, is a year ago, it was almost as if President Bush was talking to half of the room, the Republican half of the room. And on the applause lines, you know, more or less, it was the Republicans that stood up and cheered. Last night, on almost every applause line, there was two or three exceptions, but almost every applause line, everybody stood up. And one of the things he said last night that really got a good reaction on both sides of the aisle was when we were talking about education, and he talked about how the parents have responsibility and how that education has to begin at home. I don't know if y'all remember that line. I wish I had it here, and someone may have it, but there's about a two or three sentence line in that speech. I mean, both sides stood up and cheered. Well, from my standpoint, I agree with him wholeheartedly. And from my standpoint, part of this is when it comes to media literacy, is that that has to be given home. And for that to really begin at home, we have to have the tools at home to manage this resource. And so whether it's television or internet or, you know, cell phone, whatever it is, I mean, it's all changing all the time. But we have to have the tools in order to manage that. So I think what you'll find generally is a broad consensus in the Congress. You saw it last night when Obama had everybody stand up. I think you'll find generally a broad consensus on that, and the devil's always in the details, as we all know. But that's something that I would like to explore, and I'd love to have the help of people in this room to help us kind of walk through this and see what that might look like. And again, if we can just put tools into the parents' hands, and you know as well as I do, all parents are not going to exercise those things. You know how it is. Some are more involved than others, and that's just the way it is. But if we can put those tools out there and make it easy for parents to use, and part of this is parental literacy on what's going on out there, but if we can do that and do it in such a way that parents at least have the options to manage the media coming into their home or that their children have a chance to see, I think that goes a long way. Listen, I want to thank you all for having me. I know you all got a great panel and a lot of good things to talk about. Thank you very much for having
me. Thank you, Senator. Okay, now we're going to kick off our session on monitoring content. Please welcome Angela Campbell to bring us up to speed on those issues.
It's a challenge to cover sex and violence and ratings and online safety in the time I have, but I will try. And a part of the reason is that whether and how a particular medium or is regulated depends on both the type of speech at issue as well as the medium of distribution. And I made this little chart to kind of illustrate the point. Along the top, I have selected certain types of distribution systems. MVPD stands for multi-channel video program distribution. Basically, that means cable and direct broadcast satellites. And then along the other side are different kinds of speech related to sex. So if you have speech that is classified as obscene or that is child pornography, that is not considered protected by the First Amendment and can be outlawed. Now, if you have speech that we would call indecent, it is protected by the First Amendment. And there's a, as you probably know, a very famous Supreme Court case, the Seven Dirty Words case from 1978, which found that the FCC could regulate indecent speech on broadcast stations, radio and television, by channeling it till times when children were unlikely to be in the audience. And that sort of evolved into a more or less rule that said it was only, you couldn't put on indecent speech until after 10 p.m. But in other contexts where laws have been passed to try to regulate indecent speech, for example, on cable and on the internet, courts have generally found those to be unconstitutional. And so indecent speech on other forms of distribution, as well as other sexually related speech on broadcasting that doesn't amount to indecency, are not prohibited or regulated by the government except to the extent that there are tools that are sometimes voluntarily provided, sometimes not, that allow parents to both to filter or the programming and in some cases block the programming as well. But each medium, again, has a somewhat different rating scheme and different way that the parental controls work. Okay, as far as hot topics, the things that are coming up in the next few years. In the broadcasting area, as I'm sure most of you know, in the past several years, under the former FCC Chairman Martin, the FCC has really cracked down on on-air indecency, and probably the most famous case being the Janet Jackson incident at the Super Bowl. But the case that actually is now before the Supreme Court involves a Fox network and the awards programs where some of the celebrities used the F word and the S word. And the FCC used to have a policy that basically said you could, you know, if you had a fleeting expletive, that was okay. And then they changed that policy. The Court of Appeals reversed the FCC, and the FCC asked the Supreme Court to take the case. The Supreme Court heard the case argued in November. And I think the broadcast, what's interesting is the broadcast networks have tried to use the argument that they shouldn't be treated differently than anybody else and under the First Amendment, and that because there are least restrictive ways of regulating, i.e. the V-chip, that there's no reason for the FCC to engage in this time channeling. And so we're going to have to wait and see how the Supreme Court rules in this case, and then and there's other cases that will be affected as well, and also how the FCC responds to that ruling. Now that the FCC has changed, I think it's sort of an open question whether they're going to want to continue the Martin policy or whether we'll go back to the prior policy. I'm going to skip, just because of time, to the Internet as the other one that's where there's the most activity right now. There's been many attempts by Congress to essentially to prosecute or make illegal indecent content on the Internet. The first act was struck down. The second one is the Children's Online Protection Act. It was passed in 1998. It was immediately enjoined for violating the First Amendment. Then there was a lot of litigation. There was actually a trial held that examined the different kinds of filtering and blocking systems available for the Internet, at which they concluded that they were effective alternatives. That went up on appeal, and the Supreme Court just refused to hear the case. So that is the end of that law. I don't know whether Congress will try again, but after striking out twice, I think probably not. Okay, so let me move on to violence. And now, violence is not regulated. The Rockefeller bill, which was mentioned earlier, which wasn't passed, however, would have required the FCC to examine the effectiveness of rating and blocking and found of the V-chip, and it found if it was not effective, that they should prohibit the airing of excessively violent programming when children were likely to be watching. So another time channeling scheme. In 2007, the FCC did issue a report to Congress, which did look at the V-chip and the ratings and concluded that they were not effective. However, it sort of passed the ball back to Congress to pass legislation, suggested they thought it could be constitutional, but their whole analysis was based on the Pacifica case. So I think now that's sort of questionable. Congress so far has not introduced legislation to do that. Now, in the video game area, video game violence has been a big concern, and there have been several bills in Congress. None have passed. The most recent one was just introduced in January by Representatives Baca and Wolf, and it would direct the Consumer Product Safety Commission to require warnings on video games rated T or higher. The warnings that would be that the excessive exposure has been linked to aggressive behavior. On the state and local level, however, there have been a number of laws passed, and to my knowledge, all of them have been found to be unconstitutional. Just last week, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the lower court's ruling that the California law requiring that certain violent games be labeled and sold only to people 18 and over, they found that to be unconstitutional. And typically the problem that the courts have is when they apply the strict scrutiny test is they say that the state hasn't adequately demonstrated any causation between playing violent video games and any harm to children. And even if they had, that's not narrowly tailored because there are other means of addressing the problem. So I think the thing to watch here is whether California asked the Supreme Court to take this case. Now, media ratings, I'm sure you're all familiar. Different industries have different kinds of ratings. They all pretty much have an age-based component as well as some sort of content descriptors. The important issues to watch here, I think, are what happens to the V-chip with the DTV transition that we're undergoing right now. Just to be really brief about that, I think that the DTV transition offers some real opportunities to improve the ratings. The question is whether that will happen in the in the real world. The other thing to watch is this upcoming FCC proceeding that you just heard about, the Child Safe Viewing Act. At the Federal Trade Commission, they have been doing reports since 2000 looking at the marketing of violent entertainment programming and content to children in the movie industry, the recording industry, and the electronic games industries. And they have found at first that there was a great deal of marketing to children, and they've urged industry self-regulation, and they found that there's been improvement over the years. The most recent report in April 2007 found that the industries were all complying with their own voluntary standards, but they found that the voluntary standards were weak in some cases because they did allow advertising to on media that still had large numbers of children and teens, especially on the internet. And so they'll be doing an update of that report. As far as online safety, three areas that, to watch. One is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. This was passed in 1998, and out of concern that personal information could be used to connect to contact children. And so what it does is it prohibits collection of personal information from children under 13 without parental consent. And the FTC is the agency responsible for adopting rules, implementing it, enforcing it, and there are also self-regulatory programs that supplement that. Every 5 years, the FTC has to do a report on how well the rules are working. The last report, which came out in February 2007, found that they were working well. But I think that in the next review should begin in 2010, but I think there are some indications that it does need to be updated. Maybe we can talk about that later. There's a report that just came out at the end of December that was done at the request of the state attorneys general, who are concerned about enforcing crimes involving the Internet, and particularly sexual solicitation. And this report, among other things, looked at technological solutions and basically said while they were optimistic that some of them would be useful, that technology was simply no substitute for parental involvement. And finally, there's been a new act just introduced, called the Safety Act, and that would make it a crime for Internet content hosts to knowingly facilitate any access to child pornography, and also would require that providers of electronic communication services to retain records about the identity of their users, and that has raised certain privacy concerns. So I think I'm out of time, and I will go sit down.
Thank you so much, Angela. So I want to start with a big picture question. We've talked a lot about the changes of leadership on children's media policy issues. Probably none of the changes are of as much interest to us as the fact that we're going to have a new chairman of the FCC. Everybody believes it's going to be Julius Genachowski. As I say, he's a bit of a Rorschach test for those of us who are watching these issues, but there is one member of our panel who knows him and his policies perhaps better than some of the rest of us, and that's Alan Simpson. Genachowski is on the board of directors of Common Sense Media, which is one of the leading children's media organizations, advocacy groups, policy organization, ratings organization. So, and you guys have advocated a lot of different media policies with regard to kids before, and he's on the board. What can you tell us about his views on some of these issues and his take on them?
Thanks, Vicki. I'd at least caveat that obviously I can't channel Julius Genachowski, and there are limits to what I do know, but I think there are some things we can see as signs. He is a board member of an organization like Common Sense Media, specifically Common Sense Media. He's also a lawyer with First Amendment background, and he's a dad of a teenager and young kids. So he's got, I think, a lot of factors that play into this space, but I think from what we know of him with Common Sense Media, I would suggest that we're going to see someone who believes, first off, in market-based approaches where they will work to the issues that families and kids face in the media world. What can the industry provide? He worked with Barry Diller. I think he's going to look to the solutions that industry can provide as sort of the first option. That said, I think he and the president have both said that where industry does not live up to that obligation of self-regulation, maybe government does have a role. But the other big factors, I think, with Julius and the FCC is that I think the role that Common Sense Media as an organization that he helped to found plays, there are, I think, positives and negatives in the media world for kids. And I think he recognizes that as well as anyone. And I think, finally, he's going to be looking for tools from industry, from advocates, from elsewhere that will empower parents and teachers to make smart choices for kids in this media space. I think that's kind of maybe the biggest key.
Well, you know, one of the policies that you guys have advocated for before is uniform ratings across different types of media. Is that something that you're aware of, whether he has a position on that specific issue or not?
I don't know on that specific issue, and I'd also say there may be a bigger question rather than uniform ratings. The question may be more about ratings that work.
Right.
Ratings that are more accessible.
And speaking of that, if we could put the first slide up there. So he, you know, one thing that President Obama has been on the record only a couple of times on kids' media policy issues, and one of them was when he, as candidate Obama, answered the Common Sense Media presidential candidate questionnaire and did say that, you know, an FCC in an Obama administration would be more active on kids and media issues than the current one. You know, one of the first areas where there's going to be activity is on this media ratings report that I gather you guys will be issuing an NOI next week. Colin, let me ask you from the perspective of the Hill, what is it that you expect to see come out of this report to Congress from the FCC when it comes down your way next summer? What are the types of issues you think they're going to engage, and what do you think would be the next steps from the Hill?
Well, I think, I mean, the short answer is it depends. I think in many respects, what we'll get from the report is a timely update on the current state of the various media, whether it's traditional broadcast television, cable, internet, video, video games. I think it is likely that the commission will do an accounting of the current state of tools available to parents in each medium. I think they'll look at the prevalence of kids viewing such content in each medium. I think they'll look in the context of the transition to digital television, which of course will be happening simultaneous with some of the reporting that will have to go into the missive back to Congress. The DTV transition is now scheduled for June 12th for the remainder of the television stations. As was noted by Angela, the digital television transition also may avail parents with more opportunities and policymakers with more tools to look at content. But I think it also depends on what else is happening in the political landscape. Obviously, the president addressed a joint session of Congress yesterday. Members of the House and Senate are focused on larger issues of the economy, of foreign policy right now. And so in the sort of first 100 days standpoint of what the focus might be on these issues, to be candid, I think it will not be something that is a high priority for the Hill until we get past, sort of midsummer, which may come when this report arrives on the Hill. But the other big asterisk or caveat here is it also depends in large part what happens with the Fox case. And so depending on what the result of that court case is, you might find Congress and the FCC reacting in response to a court case that either gives unfettered freedom, perhaps to broadcasters, remands certain things for the FCC to look at again, or affirms the decision that the commission made. And so that court case will affect what members of Congress and what the FCC, what they feel needs to be done. And I think that's a big issue that will affect where we go.
And it'll also affect their authority.
Correct. But if it affects the FCC authority, then it, by necessity, boomerangs back to the Hill.
Okay, right. Well, Mary Beth, you're probably the person who's going to be writing this report, so as head of the Media Bureau at the FCC, what insights can you give us? And in particular, do you think this is going to turn into any kind of a rulemaking proceeding at the FCC, or is it just going to be information providing to Congress, or how do you see that unfolding?
Well, what the statute requires is that we start an inquiry on March 2nd, which is next Monday, so we'll be issuing an NOI next week to ask questions about all the issues that Senator Pryor and Colin were describing. The next requirement is to issue a report August 29th. So, you know, you can't go from an NOI to rules. Mm-hmm. I don't have any expectation in the context of this proceeding that we'd be proposing rules or starting an NPRM proceeding. The goal here is to seek comments on this range of issues having to do with blocking technologies across a wide range of platforms, and we'll find out what's out there, how it's being used, what's being developed, how we can encourage the development of new technologies, and report back to Congress, and they'll take it from there.
Okay, good enough, fair enough. David, could you put the next slide up there? We have another quote from then Senator Obama here. He has talked a number of times about the importance of media ratings for him, about parents at least having access to good information so they can make decisions. I want to ask folks from the industry, Jill and Dennis, he has called for some specific reforms, such as you see here, which is that he feels like the ratings should be displayed full screen, and they should have the words on there that says, you know, the violent programming as sexual content and so on. This happens on some channels now. Jill, you're head of the TV ratings monitoring board now, right? Okay. And so, I mean, what do you think? Do you think there's a possibility of some of these reforms that he's called for happening?
Well, we have seen some activity in this area. Fox actually recently has started putting full screen advisories up before many of their TV 14 programming. You do see on some networks, principally with TVMA programming, where there's a heightened concern about content for children. The premium networks have for a long time done this. The reality is that there's a distinction between a full screen on a premium network and a basic cable network or a broadcast channel because of the advertising issues and the expense of using time to put on a full screen. It's just an issue that would need to be considered as we talk about it. But it is an area mm-hmm. that industry members of the monitoring board have talked about, and I think we should continue to talk about that. In terms of information, I do think the digital arena gives us better ability to get information. When you push the info button on a cable remote, up comes little screen that gives you information about the program, including the rating. Some cable companies have started including in that an actual use of the descriptors and what those descriptors mean in the context of, for example, a TV 14 mm-hmm. program. So that is an area where we can provide some additional information.
Well, Dennis, I mean, as a representative of the broadcasters here, what do you think about the possibility of those full screen ratings with the explanations for broadcast stations?
Well, I do know that some broadcasters, when you come out of commercials, will put up the screen, the rating in the top corner. I don't know if any of them have actually considered the full screen rating. I think it's something worthy of discussion. The one thing that I would caution is confusing parents. I mean, I remember back when this whole process began back in '95. I was still a reporter at the time, and you know, we created the rating system. Originally, it was a sort of an age-based system. You were there, mm-hmm. I think, and it was based on sort of Jack Valenti's movie rating system, and it was considered simple at the time. We thought it was a good idea. Some of the groups, after we unveiled the program, went to Congress and complained that it was not complex enough in terms of giving enough information, so we added the VSLD, FV verbiage, and some would say it complicated things. So any changes that are made, I would just caution that we need to make it simple enough for parents so that they understand what this is all about.
Right. David, if you could put the next slide up. I mean, one thing that Obama did say here that was a little bit controversial was that if the and this was with regard to the ratings and specifically providing parents with more information that was easier to understand. If the industry fails to act, if it fails to give parents advanced controls and new choices, Congress will. Is there anybody who thinks Congress really will do that, would do that? Colin, what do you think?
Well, the short answer is it depends.
I'm detecting a theme here.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about the television rating system, and again, I do recall when the original rating system came out, which was age-based, I think the line that my boss had was that, you know, they had taken the V out of the V-chip. And different parents have different concerns, and I do think most parents want to know some content indicators as to the show their child may or may not get to watch in the next half hour. Some parents are more concerned about violence than they are about language. Some parents are more concerned about sex than they are about violence. And so indicating, as you would with food labeling, you know, some indicators with respect to the content is, I think, helpful to most most parents. I think the rating system is also one of those issues where, to the extent to which the industry is able to give parents greater flexibility and tools that parents find more useful, it acts not only as an incredible arsenal of power for parents across the country, but it also can act as a shield for industry against more intrusive government regulation of content. And so as the more useful the industry makes the rating system, the more assistance it gives to parents, the lesser the likelihood that I think members of Congress will feel a necessity to get more deeply into content issues, and it's always a tricky issue with the First Amendment in that respect. But one of the issues with respect to the First Amendment to remember is that the test is typically that Congress or the regulator has chosen the least restrictive means. And people often forget the rest of the line, which is the least restrictive means necessary to achieve the policy goal of, in this case, protecting the interests of children. So if you choose the least restrictive means and it doesn't work, then I think many courts will allow you to go a little bit further into a more restrictive manner to achieve the policy goal. And I think that's something that the industry has to look at. The final sentence, just to go back to the reason why I said it depends, is that, again, depending on the outcome of the Fox case, and this is an area where, you know, for broadcasters, it's really one of these issues of be careful what you wish for. If the court case winds up allowing a free over-the-air broadcaster to air at any time of the day content which is similar to that which you can get on HBO, I think you will find more members of Congress concerned about possible transgressions of what might be, you know, sort of a community assumption of what that trusteeship means in their local community.
Well, let's talk about indecency for a second. If you could put up the next slide there. I mean, President Obama has also said that this is an issue that's very difficult to regulate our way out of and that he wouldn't really want to. Most observers think that the issue of indecency is one that's going to diminish in prominence under this administration. Tim Winter, you're shaking your head. You disagree?
I do disagree. First of all, I think that with the current rating system, the current controls that are in place, if they were effective, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be having this conversation at all. When you have, I think, the Congress with its finger on the pulse of the American people on this issue, we believe that Congress will act when it becomes necessary for them to do so. And I think based on what we've heard from Mr. Obama and from those who are now in greater control in the Senate and the House, this is something they will step in and take more action on because – it's becoming less, under this new FCC, I believe it will be less of a culture war issue and more of a children's health issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an excellent
indecency?
Way to... Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. When we talk about the correlation of child behavior and the media they consume, and Kaiser has been out in the front on this for many years, I think that when you frame the issue as a children's health issue, it becomes much more palatable to those who otherwise might not go along
well,
with what they see as a culture war issue.
Some types of content, I'm thinking violent content, which is not included in indecency, or sexual content, which isn't necessarily included in indecency.
Well, just beyond the profanity issue, and, yeah. And Colin, I think you're right about the what's going to happen when that court ruling comes down. But when we're talking about sex and violence, Rockefeller and Pryor, again, these are issues that go to the very heart of parenting in every family in the country. And
well, Dennis Wharton, your boss was quoted in today's paper, in the Newsday, saying, with the new FCC, I think there will be less focus on cultural issues. No FCC, another person quoted in the article said, no FCC chairman will announce he's not going to pay attention to broadcast content, but the commission sends signals, and the Obama administration so far seems to have a lot less interest in playing traffic cop. Do you have any evidence of signals that says that this issue is not going to be as high on their radar screen?
It depends. Look, if there's another Janet Jackson incident, all bets are off, seriously. But I want to go back to what Colin suggested on if the broadcasters actually win the Supreme Court case, the notion that we're going to be just we're dying to drop F-bombs in prime time. I mean, we could do that now if we wanted to. Remember, indecency does not apply from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Right.
David Letterman and Jay Leno could be using F-words and S-words. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we are broadcasters, not narrowcasters, not niche satellite TV or internet or cable providers. It's a broad audience that we're seeking. And we respond to parents' pressure, advertiser pressure. I don't think broadcasters are going to go down that road if we win that case.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's segue into violence for a second here. We do have a new chairman of the Commerce Committee who is somebody who has tried to regulate violent content and put it in the same category with indecent content for the FCC to regulate. Dale Kunkel, why don't I turn to you on this issue since you've done so much research on violence in the past. How do you see this issue unfolding with Rockefeller as chair of the Senate Commerce Committee?
I think that the topic's going to get attention, and that's no surprise. Not everyone may be aware, but one of the implications of the stimulus bill is that there's a windfall of money that's going to NIH for research. What that means, there are many people in the children and media community or advocacy community have been advocating for legislation called CAMRA that would provide more research funding. They just got more. There's really more funding in NIH now that's going to go to a whole panoply of different topic areas, but I'd be very surprised if we don't see some additional children and media research coming through NIH. And it's going to encompass a broad range. Other topics we'll get to later, advertising to children and so forth, but I suspect that some violence research will be in there, in particular looking at new technologies, not just television.
Some of this research money to NIH is specifically dedicated to research on kids and media? Or
No, it's not, but I just expect that because these issues are so important, that NIH is likely to engage them. So I expect the key contribution of research is to serve to inform policymakers, to inform the public, to be a catalyst for dialogue and debate, and I think as we see new research, that's going to contribute to a resurgence of interest in the topic.
Well, here's a quote from Jay Rockefeller. All our other quotes up here are from Obama, but for the most part. He wants to give the FCC explicit authority over violent programming and give them authority over cable and satellite programming as well. Does Jeff McIntyre, Jill Luckett, either of you want to comment on what you see as the likelihood of something like this coming to pass, or do you think that now that he's chairman, this is something that maybe he won't be pushing so much anymore, or what?
Well, to pick up on Dennis's line that we're kind of one Janet Jackson incident away from indecency concerns, we're also only kind of one school shooting away from concerns about the role of violence in our kids' lives. And so, yeah, there is a real possibility for this, I think. I don't know that we will necessarily see this sort of panacea approach to it that Senator Rockefeller is proposing, but I think it's very likely that we start kind of rising the tide on this, that there may be some approaches. Senator Rockefeller has offered in the past variations on what was Senator Hollings' idea of a Safe Harbor Act for violent and indecent programming. You know, there's a lot of different options here as opposed to just kind of expanding FCC authority in a more blanket approach.
Well, you know, one of the places where there's violent content that people focus on a lot, especially when there's a school shooting, is in video games. So, Rich Taylor, I'm going to turn to you now. If you could put the next quote from Obama up there, David. Obama keeps talking about video games, and most recently last night in his State of the Union address. You know, I see in the blogosphere a lot of the video game aficionados kind of upset about this. Beyond just talking about saying we got to turn it off every once in a while, do you have concerns or about or an indication of any policies that they're thinking of that might affect video game industry?
Well, I can't channel Obama any better than you can channel Alan, your folks. But first, if I can, just a matter of just want to say both Vicky and David how happy I am to be here. This Kaiser Foundation has always puts on such a top-notch event, and when you called, I was very happy you invited us to be a part of this, invited me to be a part of it, plus you've got the best breakfast buffet in town. And it's free. But in answer to your question, I think where President Obama is on this is precisely where we are. I think we've been responsive to exactly the kind of parental help that he's seeking. More information for parents, more access to the parents. I mean, Senator Pryor spoke about Internet access, and it does have, you know, dangerous elements and implications as well, but it can also be a very positive tool. We recently, the ratings board, the ESRB, which is the video game ratings board equivalent of the movie rating system, recently put together a mobile website. It's m.esrb.org. So if you're in a store, pop it into your iPhone, pop it into your mobile device, and you can enter in a title of a video game that your kid's pulling on your arm, begging you to buy, and get all the information about it, what it's rated, as well as additional rating summaries, which is also a new tool that we've added on for parents. In addition to the rating, you can get the details of why a certain title received that rating. No less a one-time, pretty serious critic of the industry than Senator Clinton has called that a great gift to parents and exactly the kind of response that we want industries to be providing. So, you know, the idea that parents need to be involved, absolutely. The idea that there should be limits, we agree with. An idea that the industry has a role to make that easier for parents to do, we also agree with. And we're trying to do our best and do our part to be as responsive to the call, not just to President Obama, but by parents everywhere for those that type of information.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the Internet now and online safety, youth risk issues. So one of the issues is that the FCC is going to be talking about ratings on video games as well as on, you know, cable and broadcast and the Internet. What do you think about having the FCC give a report to Congress about issues of concerning media ratings and parental controls on the Internet?
I want to just also echo the thanks Richard just mentioned. Great breakfast because I missed mine this morning, so thank you, Vicky. I think it's new. I think it's different. We're always enthusiastic and interested in having folks look at this new converging world that we have and to consider new ways or new technologies to help parents, to give them the tools to protect their kids in whichever way they wish to do so. But I think we have some concerns about the FCC's reach here and its scope. And while I have great sympathy for what Senator Pryor was talking about, this sort of thing opens the door to the potential, the unintended consequence, for instance, of the FCC becoming an agency which will, over time, take on that role which up until now they've not had. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some concerns there.
Can you put the next quote from Obama up there? He has talked about requiring Internet service providers to offer parental controls. Are there some who don't do that now? And what do you think about the likelihood of that kind of a policy moving forward?
Well, first of all the major internet service providers, and I include the mobile operators in that too, because the cell phones are obviously the new platform. It's a platform of choice, certainly for my 12-year-old, to get online. And all of those have parental controls. Some of them are quite sophisticated. I can access my daughter's parental controls from here, from my own mobile phone. So in addition to that, we have the two major operating systems, both Microsoft's Vista but also Apple's operating system, have parental controls built into them. So you don't have to download anything. You can do it right there. And, in fact, those are the controls that we often recommend to parents to use, because it's some of the most sophisticated family safety settings we've found. To move to requirement, unfortunately, when you start using the R word in this town, the lawyers all come flooding out and start to fight things in the courts and saying, you're now restricting my First Amendment rights to express myself, whatever. So I think I can see the desire for the now President Obama to use his bully pulpit to say we will move in and make this a requirement. My hope is that he would keep to strongly advising and keeping a watchful eye over the industry.
Have you had conversations with the administration about some of the things that you've been pushing for, like more online safety education, or are you still waiting to do that?
It depends. No, we've had talks. We've had some initial contacts with folks from the transition team. Mm-hmm. Nothing that we can put on record. On the other hand, at our annual conference in December, we did call upon the new administration to emulate what the Clinton administration did, and that's to have an annual White House summit on online safety. We've also called for a internet safety educational program, not dissimilar to what we have in the European Union, that's been running for 10 years now, to fund innovative educational activities and collaborations between the nonprofit sector and the for-profit sector.
Well, I think that NCTA and Common Sense Media had a proposal for some of the money in the stimulus package to be used for digital education. What, Jill or Alan, what was the status of that? Did that get through?
I don't think there's anything specific in the stimulus, but the language in the bill is fairly broad-based, and actually Alan and I were just talking this morning about the possibility of continuing to push for that kind of funding. We've got a long-standing commitment to media literacy, and it's moved into the online space, and we're working with Alan and Stephen and some of these groups on online safety and trying to get parental resources out there. And I think the stimulus is another possibility to look for funds.
Okay. We are going to see if there's anybody who wants to ask a quick question from the audience on any of the topics that we've covered so far before we move to our second topics. Is there any? Angela Campbell. She's got it. Down to the bottom.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is for Richard Taylor. I was curious about the fact that you have this rating system, and it, like the movie rating system, movie theaters generally do not permit people under 18 to go see the NC-17 movies. So why has the industry fought so hard all of the attempts by states to just limit the sales of games that are rated inappropriately for children, prohibit the direct sales to those children? It just seems to me, I don't know why you would care about that, because if parents want their children to watch those, play those games, of course they can purchase the games for them anyhow.
Well, I think I would rewind, start how these court cases end up and these laws end up, which is they're unconstitutional. I don't know why any industry or any individual should allow something that is patently unconstitutional to be foisted upon them. Plus, the treatment of video games as pornography, which is essentially what a lot of this legislation has made it into law, has done, is just patently unfair and misguided. So we will challenge those when those appear. We strongly respect and encourage parents to be actively engaged. The retail partners that we work closely with are strong in enforcement. The latest FTC report shows remarkable improvement in our industry on that front, to the point where it's probably the gold star of those who were examined. So I really feel like that is a unconstitutional solution in search of a problem. We'll keep providing the information. We'll keep applying hard ratings. I mean, I will say, unlike on the movie side, you know, we do have titles that come in at that hard M level. And those do present a challenge. You can't be a young kid just to walk in and buy it. A parent needs to buy it, and parents are involved in these purchases at a fairly high rate, at an 80% level and plus, a purchase of all video games. Mm-hmm. So that encourages us that they are actually paying attention and being a partner in those decisions about what kind of entertainment they're bringing into their home.
Mary Beth, is your report going to look at movie ratings and music ratings too? Do you know?
The statute does talk about ratings in terms of our analysis of the blocking technologies, that we should be looking at technologies that will work with ratings that are not assigned by the content creators.
Mm-hmm.
And it also talks about blocking technologies that will block indecent and objectionable programming that based upon the parent's preference. In other words, there's a focus on ensuring that parents get information that's helpful to them, and maybe one size fits all doesn't work for that.
Okay. Tim Winter, is this something where if they allow a third-party rating, you foresee that a group like yours might have your own rating system that would somehow actually work with the V-chip and block content?
I think that the ultimate outcome will be that the industry's attempt to rate their own content won't be enough, whether it's Common Sense, whether it's ours, whether it's other organizations. Every bit of information for a parent is good information, but ultimately it can't rely on a rating system that is provided by somebody who has a inherent financial conflict of interest for their product not to be consumed.
Okay. One more quick question from the audience. Lisa?
Hi, I'm Lisa Guernsey, and I'm now writing for Early Ed Watch regularly. I've written about early childhood and media. I'm curious maybe if someone up there could address the question of violence and what we might see or anticipate when it comes to differentiating by a child's age. If there are any undercurrents out there of looking at, see what the difference might be between, say, a 3 or 4-year-old seeing aggression and, say, an 8-year-old, and if we've gotten to a point where parents might have more information about their own children's kind of development and their understanding of violence. Thanks.
Dale, do you want to take that?
Well, there's a lot of research that addresses that question. For example, we know that as children reach about the age of 8 and they develop an awareness of fiction versus reality discriminations, that has some impact on the way the violence influences them. When children understand that violence is fictional, then they take it a little less seriously. Unfortunately, all children in the younger ages, then they tend to think that everything that we as adults know is fictional is real, and so it has a more profound effect. The challenge is in getting that information to parents. Not all parents have a background in developmental perspectives on media comprehension, and so that's where media literacy and ratings information comes into play. I have sympathy for Dennis's point that you can't make ratings so complicated that parents can't use them. On the other hand, I see us having moved through at least 2 eras of media ratings so far. In the 1980s, we had source-based ratings. People aren't generally aware, but the Cable Act of 1984 had a legal requirement that cable operators would block channels that parents objected to. Then in the 90s with the V-chip, we went to content-based ratings. That is to say, we didn't just block an entire source one at a time, but rather we blocked on the basis of content. But we've done that so far at such a rudimentary level, that is to say, we have such a limited number of content categories that we can't can't really take into account information like the perspective you're presenting here. So I think the challenge is, with this new ratings report we're going to see the FCC produce, can we move beyond that rudimentary level of content ratings, and can we have more elaborate, more informative, more valuable tools for parents with content, more what I would say would be the third era, which would be more sophisticated content ratings.
Okay, with that, we're going to move to the next topic area that we have today, which is encouraging excellence. We're going to look at the possibilities for support for children's and educational media content via PBS, yes, but also without overlooking private options and emerging digital platforms. We're going to consider the future of EI programming in the transition to digital television and look at government support for research into the media's evolving roles in child development. And to help kick off this discussion, Amy Jordan is going to bring us up to speed on these topics.
Great. Thank you, Vicki. Here, make this. Everybody can hear me in the back there? Good. Yeah, I have the privilege of being able to shift the conversation from what we worry about in the media to the kinds of potential benefits that the media might have for developing children. So thank you for giving me that assignment. And to echo what Senator Pryor was talking about when he made his comments, it made me think about the 5 years or so that we at the Annenberg Public Policy Center were looking at the landscape of children's programming. And in the 90s, when we were doing these evaluations, we would identify the individual titles that were available airing on public and commercial and basic cable stations. And in Philadelphia, my market, we would find 300 individual titles. And that seemed like such an overwhelming number of TV shows to content analyze, and it was. But I think back on those days as sort of like the golden age of television research, because when children watched television, it was on TV. So, you know, we might tell our kids today, when we watch TV shows, we actually had to turn on the TV set, because today's generation, they're watching TV on Hulu, right? They're watching their favorite shows on DVD. They get to choose their programs on demand. So it's a very different kind of experience, I think, than it was even 10 years ago. So where's my clicker? Here we go. When I was given this assignment to give you a kind of framework for thinking about educational media as encouraging and ways to encourage excellence in media for children, we identified three different areas that we wanted to focus on for these remarks. So one is the federal support and for an encouragement of children's educational media, so really regulations and monies that go along with that. Secondly, federal mandates like the FCC processing guideline, known as the three-hour rule, so we'll consider that. And then finally, we'll look at research and funding initiatives that are in the pipeline to hopefully consider where those are at today. So let me start with federal support. The formal name is the Schools and Libraries Program of the Universal Service Fund, right? That's the E-rate program. The E-rate program is intended to ensure that schools and libraries have access to affordable telecommunications and information services. And we've heard about this a little bit already, and particularly for schools that are in low-income or rural communities. And under the direction of the FCC, about $2.5 billion a year has been collected and dispersed through this E-rate program. President Obama announced in a recent radio address that his administration would seek to expand broadband access in schools. And as was already mentioned, the stimulus package contains about $1 billion for technology programs and to bring broadband access to underserved communities, and an additional $6 billion would go toward beefing up what's available in schools. Those numbers aren't exactly, I'm not entirely sure if those numbers still hold, but that was my understanding. We also get to think about in this conversation about the Department of Education's Ready to Learn initiative or partnership. And that partnership has invested close to $200 million in children's educational television programming. And it goes all the way back to about 2000. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Ready to Learn, for those who aren't as familiar with the specifics, it's a program that supports the development of educational media for preschool and elementary, early elementary school age kids. And the focus here is primarily on literacy. And one of the interesting elements of the Ready to Learn initiative is that it doesn't just think about the child without the context that the child is raised in, their schools and their family. So there's also a good deal of outreach materials that go along with these programs. Some of the shows that have emerged as a result of Ready to Learn include Between the Lions, Super Why, most recently, The New Electric Company. That's the show I grew up with. Ready to Learn currently is funded at about $23 million a year. That funding stream has stayed kind of stagnant, so we'll see where the next administration brings that. Another important organization within the federal government, the National Science Foundation. They've been active in funding media production as an informal science education. They have the goal of increasing students' interests and skills related to science, technology, engineering, and math. So this is their STEM grant program. And they've totaled more than $10 million in the last year and a half or so. And they've funded programs including, this always makes me laugh when I say it, a show called Fetch with Ruff Ruffman, Peep in the Big Wide World, and Dragonfly TV. Both the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Public Broadcasting Services are working to identify best practices, and they're trying to figure out how the kinds of things they've funded, how that might inform us about ways to ideally teach through media and what kind of context children need to really have the most takeaway value from these programs. So PBS, for example, they've convened a Next Generation Advisory Board, and that advisory board will help figure out how to extend the educational mission of public service broadcasting to all the platforms that children are using today. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is also considering ways that public media and public schooling can complement and converge around a set of well-defined curricula. So I think that's important to recognize how schools and all of the time that children are spending with media might converge around a common goal. Okay, so I'm going to move ahead here to educational and informational programming. So Angela and Dale are probably, squirming in your seats, because really the three-hour rule is not a rule. It's an FCC processing guideline, so we want to be clear about that. And the FCC processing guideline is really a clarification of the guidelines for educational programming, a mandate that came out of the Children's Television Act of 1990. And it requires commercial broadcasters to air 3 hours a week of educational or informational programming for kids to qualify for expedited license renewal. So they don't have to do it, but if they want to go through the renewal process easily, then they should. In 2006, the FCC adopted rules for extending the mandate to digital television, calling for a commensurate amount of educational programming per digital channel a broadcaster is providing. It's a little more complicated than that, and you can get into the conversation, but it was interesting to see that those rules were extended to digital. Now, Children Now just recently conducted an assessment of the current landscape of EI programs. And one of the things that they found was that more than two-thirds of the programs were not the kinds of shows that we see being funded by Ready to Learn or the National Science Foundation, dealing with educational curricula like science or math or literacy. Rather, the commercial broadcasters' programs are typically pro-social in nature. That is, they tend to help children with techniques for feeling good about themselves or getting along well with others. So, and about a third of the programs that are out there airing as EI are traditionally academic. There are also some educationally rich programs that tend not to come across the radars of research projects like what Dale did with Children Now and what we've done with the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And these are hard to find for many of us because they have yet to find an audience because they haven't found their way into the current cable structure. So we should consider that when we're thinking about the future of technologies. Research. So with the rapid changes of how media technology are being used by children, frankly, a lot of the research that we've done is outdated. It's outdated. And we need to figure out how to put aside dedicated pools of funds and set up a clear research agendas to try to figure out media's its ongoing role in the life of the developing child, but its emerging role as well. As was mentioned in the last discussion, there is this bill that's been circulating for many years now, the Children's Media Research Advancement Bill. And it aims to do just that, create an organized, coherent research and funding agenda. And it would be housed for new media technologies. It would be housed within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's been raised twice. It's stalled. I understand that it's going to be introduced again within the next month or so through the HELP Committee via Senators Lieberman and Brownback. The National Center for Research in Advanced Information and Digital Technologies, we need an acronym for that, is another effort. It would establish a nonprofit corporation within the Department of Education, and it would support a comprehensive research and development program that would explore ways that advanced computer and communication technologies could improve all levels of children. So we're not just talking about the very youngest children. We're really thinking about learners across a lifespan. It was passed and authorized in the 110th Congress, but no funding. The funds have not yet been appropriated. So I want to end on a hopeful note. There are other developments of potential for funding. As Dale mentioned, one very important governmental organization that oversees a lot of media-related research, the National Institutes of Health, has received an infusion of funds from the stimulus package. Also, the Department of Education. So I think many of us are waiting with our fingers crossed and hoping that we will see media high on the agenda and new research initiatives aimed at better understanding how these new media technologies are affecting our youngest children. Let me conclude by saying that the people at this table and many people in this audience that I've seen today are people who have spent much of their professional lives really trying to figure out how to improve media and the role of media in the life of the developing child. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what you anticipate a new administration might bring. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. And as I work my way over to the Oprah position where Vicky has set such a high standard for how to moderate this, I have to ask a question, just a show of hands, since we're talking about youth and media. Anybody here live Twittering this? One, two. Welcome to the new world. So as we've just been hearing, a healthy children's media environment isn't just about the things that we don't want children to have access to. It's got to be about a firm belief that young people have a desire and maybe even a right to high-quality content across a variety of genres, across a variety of technologies. It's my belief that you can't legislate quality, but that you can use policy to put in place the funding, the platforms, and the knowledge about the audience that's going to let quality flourish. And that's what we're going to be discussing over the next half hour or so. Many of you went online and participated in our little question and answer session so that we'd have a sense of what you came into the room thinking was likely to happen in the next couple of years. And just to give you a very quick feedback from that, 45% of you believe that support for PBS and other public service media platforms is going to become more prominent in the next 2 years. And 70% of you believe that there will be policy change when it comes to investment in educational media and technology, with a, sort of a balance between those who think that will come from the legislative branch, from Congress, or from the executive branch. a very strong 75% of you think that research on children and media is going to become more prominent in the next 2 years, with the anticipation that Congress is going to be the one investing in that research. And just under half of you who answered the questions project no change in prominence for educational TV requirements. Not surprisingly, then, just over 50% predict no policy changes in that area. Can I have the first slide, please? We have what might be seen as two ideas in conflict here. We've got competing forces, a president and a Congress that are disposed to strong support for public service, for public broadcasting, and a very tight economy. Public TV, Current just had an article yesterday, is asking for emergency supplemental funding. Turning to Rob Lippincott, what do you see as, what are your expectations for public broadcasting funding, and does the case that needs to be made for public broadcasting change in the face of the changing economy?
Thanks, David. First of all, I should say that we feel like we have a very strong educational mission. In fact, one of our little mottos is that we educate with everything we do. But as Paula's quote here shows, we don't think that anything that we have done in the past makes us deserving of support in the future. And I think that's what is going to be the constant over the next several years, is really making a very clear, very specific case based on merit, based on, well, we'll certainly play our, if you will, trust card. We have been recognized again by the Roper Institution for the sixth year in a row as the most trusted organization in the United States, public broadcasting. We like that. We like the feel of that. We think that's an obligation as well as a merit. What we are after now is efficaciousness. In other words, efficacy in the school. And to pick up on what was talked about already in the introduction, it's not just about ratings. We've got great ratings. Curious George is the number one show for youngest kids. Nova is the long-reigning first choice of informal science educators. We are very proud of those broadcast ratings. We are very proud of what we've done, as Paula said, extraordinary accomplishments. But increasingly, we need to do, in fact, exactly what has been at the heart of the Ready to Learn funding, which is to start from a very explicit curricular goal and aim our activity at that goal with using research before we start, knowing what the curriculum really calls for, while we work on it, formative research, every single version of every single script, and in fact, summative research, what actually happened. And that's the kind of thing that we think by putting down those markers, and in fact, I think the best case study that we can make right now, very fresh results from the Annenberg School of Communication at University of Pennsylvania, some research that is part of the Ready to Learn. The current version, by the way, is a partnership between CPB, PBS, and the Ready to Learn partnership, producing our what we call icon series within the Ready to Learns, the Sesame Street and Between the Lions, but also our new star, Super Y, Word World, Martha Speaks, and our most recent rejoining program, the Electric Company. All of those are part of the Ready to Learn funding on television, but they're also very carefully designated to work with specific pieces of a curriculum. The World of Words curriculum based on reading panel findings of 2000, so that the research I'm talking about, just about to be published, shows that in five of the seven key areas, after watching television, watching Super Y in a very carefully controlled experiment, kids, especially the kids in the lowest socioeconomic categories with the highest poverty and the lowest skills to start with, are showing dramatic changes. So we need to put down specific markers that show we are making progress, that we, quote, move the needle. And I think that's going to be the constant, that we need to make the case for public broadcasting broadly, where we do find the environment very receptive. We feel like we're very much in line with so many of the programs, the ideas, the hopes that we even heard about last night. But in every single case, we think we need to make a better case for, and in this case, for teaching children, for working directly with them. In fact, we've evolved specifically the notion of it's not all about television. In fact, it's well beyond television. It's, in fact, we've really reinvented the notion of outreach. We really call that community engagement, and we call that a 360-degree approach to education. We're going everywhere kids are living and learning, not just over the air. Increasingly, of course, that means technology, has been talked about, cell phones and the Internet, and in fact, reinventing television, I think.
Colin, your boss has always been a very strong proponent of public broadcasting. Senator Rockefeller in the Senate, a big supporter of public broadcasting. Is the argument that you're hearing from Rob, last night we heard the president talking about the importance of education, are those the winning arguments in a tight economy for continued support?
Yes, and I think public broadcasting has very strong supporters on Capitol Hill. You know, my boss and others fought back attempts in previous sessions to gut or cut funding. And when it was pushed to a vote, it typically won in overwhelming fashion. And the reason for that, I think, is because it is recognized as really the parent's best friend. From 6 in the morning until, you know, 6 p.m., it really is an electronic oasis for children and a medium where parents can feel comfortable with their children watching. I think the case to be made is the case that the president was making last night, which is that, yes, times are tough, but it's not a time to eschew investing in the future. And so the investment argument that public broadcasting makes in the next generation, the investment in the system, in new media and where the children are going with their viewing habits, I think is something that will be compelling to a lot of members and to the administration. I think it is one of these things that a lot of public broadcasters have already started to make that investment themselves. I know our flagship public broadcasting station up in Massachusetts, WGBH, has a long history of investing in new technologies, you know, whether it was accessibility for closed captioning or whether it's now with the digitization of their fairly impressive and immense library of content that now can be accessible and through other media and other apertures electronically, I think is something that I think a lot of people will want to see. And it's not just, as was noted, it's not just about broadcasting anymore. It really is about public service media generally. The final piece, in addition, I know we talk about kids and the focus is on children here, but there is also a role, I think a renewed role for public broadcasting in news and information and civic involvement, particularly at a time where you see the distress that many newspapers are in. And there's a natural role that I think public broadcasters can play in that area as well. And I think that's another investment in local communities that I think public broadcasters will do well if they, you know, press that case repeatedly.
Rob, let me come back to Ready to Learn just very briefly. I just wanted to follow up as a Chicagoan, we're sending you some of our best here, and including the new education secretary, who's been a strong advocate for early learning. Have you had conversations, or has public broadcasting had conversations with Secretary Duncan to find out if he's predisposed to Ready to Learn, to educational media in particular?
As you can imagine, we're working very closely with the Department of Education. We have the Ready to Learn partnership. We also have a Ready to Teach grant from the Department of Education right now. The leadership of public broadcasting, including CPB and PBS and APPS, also met with Arne Duncan before he was confirmed. And in fact, we've begun what we hope is a very frequent partnership kind of discussion about how we can best deploy the resources of public media to serve these kinds of goals. We don't have any specific flags or indications, I think, except to say that all the goals of Ready to Learn seem like they're much more firmly enshrined in what the Department of Education has been talking about. Early childhood, in other words, the whole start early notion and building on literacy. We believe that we're poised to take the lessons we've learned about literacy in some markets much more broadly nationally, and also to take the lessons we've learned about literacy much more into the area, for instance, of STEM. And so working with the Department of Education and, frankly, other government agencies is something that we look forward to.
I want to broaden this out to some other people on the panel right now. In the infrastructure bill and in Obama's platform, President Obama's platform, there's been a lot of talk about the infrastructure funding for digital media, especially for schools and for learning. A friend of mine here in the audience has talked for a long time about the last 18 inches, about the pipes are only as good as the content that goes into them. So I'd love to hear from a range of you, if you see opportunities out there right now, possibilities not just for public broadcasting, for cable, for broadcast, for the gaming industry that would support that infrastructure that's being laid out with new educational content?
I'll take a first crack at it. There wasn't any specific money in there for this mission, and I think you have to take into account the context. The stimulus bill in its ideal form was a jobs bill, so it was about the deployment of infrastructure and about getting the infrastructure out there. However, it did give fairly broad flexibility to the implementing agencies to look at applicants for grants for the deployment of the infrastructure in a way that looked at whether the applicant's request for funding was to build an infrastructure that would have palpable benefits, and it included education. It included computer literacy, computer ownership. It specifically included children. And so there was a litany of things that a grant applicant could make the case for, and the implementing agency could then look at what was being requested as part of a plan. Many of the applicants we expect will come not just from private sector providers of broadband access to the internet, but also from municipalities and also from public-private partnerships that will come together to reach certain unserved or underserved areas. There will be other funding measures, and so I think not only in the petitions to the agency for the grants based upon what local organizing can be done around this, but also in future funding measures, I think there'd be an opportunity to look at content, media literacy, and also one of the things that when we did the E-rate provision in the 1996 Telecommunications Act, my boss named it the E-rate for education rate. And it was for schools and libraries, K-12 schools and libraries, E-rate for education rate. One of the things that did not get in the final version was teacher training. There are other things that are valuable to go in conjunction with a funding mechanism or an infrastructure project, and it goes to sort of the software and human dimensions of how that technology is animated with the human values that actually impart the knowledge and the values to the kids. And so that is something that I think people would like to come back and look at, because the course, the computer in the classroom is only as good as the teacher's ability to animate that technology for the learning that needs to be done. And the teacher relies upon other people for training and on the software and educational materials, the course curricula that can help infuse the technology with the content that is most meaningful for the kids. So I think we will see a lot more in that area, not only through the traditional mechanisms, but through new mechanisms as well.
I'd like to add to that. I agree completely with Colin, and we think it's essential at Common Sense Media that this investment in broadband really come with more of an investment in the digital literacy and citizenship components. Many of us have discussed this about how it's an important aspect of how we keep kids safe and make sure keep kids learn in this media environment, but the reality that we find in a lot of schools who are well-positioned in a community sense to deliver that sort of digital literacy and media education are not prepared for it. Some schools are, many are not, and many teachers are themselves behind in that digital gap, just like parents are. And so one of the reasons we launched our Common Sense Schools project this past year is to sort of reach out to exactly that audience and to help schools reach out to parents with more information. And it's a logical connection to the broadband investment. It really will help us as a country make the most out of that broadband investment.
So we really have a three-step process here. We've got laying the pipes, then we've got making sure that there's a receptive audience at the end of teachers able to use the content. But in the middle, we really need strong content for...
I just want to chime in on a couple of things that have been said already. Clearly, if we have good content, why aren't we done? And that's because television doesn't work in the classroom. In fact, most teachers don't want a television in the classroom. They want media in the classroom. But what they need is media that's aligned to their standards, that's packaged into the way that they think about curriculum, that's a retrievable by keyword that they can get at, and it's digitally manipulable. A godsend called E-rate and the E2T2 legislation and others have really done a lot of wiring, short perhaps of the last 18 inches in a few cases. And we do need to renovate that, because as we all know from our home use, bandwidth is bandwidth. I mean, it's kind of through the cloud, whatever you get. We need reliably available bandwidth right to teachers' desks. But there is no teacher that I know of who's saying, give me a little, we tried an internet thing, we're not doing that again this year. Or, yeah, I don't need as much bandwidth as I used to need. Everyone has said, please give me more. And what they, of course, mean is both of the things we've just been talking about. Much better resources. I want purpose-built, in other words, just for my need, 3 minutes of video, or an interactive that works with my level of kids. And they also need the ability. And frankly, we've just run an interesting study on the teacher line, which is our PBS teacher line, is the ready-to-teach grant-funded professional development service that we've been running for the last 6 years. We've educated about 42,000 teachers in an online environment. And Old Dominion University just published a study in the Journal of Computing and Technology and Education saying that teachers achieved a better level of competence and confidence using technology in the classroom. We think this is absolutely a vital building block. So if we can give teachers the confidence and competence, and if we can give them the right kinds of media, we think we can really change kids' performance, which, of course, is the gold standard.
Sandy.
Congress last year also passed and the President signed into law the National Center for Research in Advanced Information and Digital Technologies. And this really has the potential to revolutionize the educational system. It's directed at K-12, formal and informal learning, prototypical systems being built, really looking at all kinds of tools, digital tools, gaming. So it brings together this formal and informal, looking at how we can best go about infusing new directions and personalized education in school systems. They've asked for about $50 million this year. It's unclear whether they're going to get it, but it's housed in the Department of Education. So this is one direction that I see the infrastructure being built that could potentially revolutionize content in the educational system.
Time is amazingly flying by here, so we are necessarily sort of giving a quick overview of some of these topics. I want to move on quickly to EI, to the educational informational requirements. Put up the slide there. And this one I really think we're going to go by fairly quickly. I mostly want to know, does anyone on the panel believe that there will be a tightening of the definition of educational and informational qualifying programs coming up as a priority in the next 2 years? Does anyone see that as emerging, as likely as it going to come from Congress or from the FCC if that does happen?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, one of the things that we found based on the Children Now study that happened was that there was such a broad range of what qualified as educational informational programming. We've seen even in prior incarnations of EI studies that there were times when licenses were being renewed for the Flintstones teaching history and the Jetsons teaching science. I think we're kind of past that day now, and as we look at it, we still have this really broad area where a lot of stuff is being qualified as educational. And I think we would like to see a tightening of the definition on that, not necessarily a restructuring of the definition. And in the conversations I've had with folks at the Commission on the Hill, there is that has been qualified to me as excuse me, quote-unquote, low-hanging fruit to be able to get uniform sort of agreement on, to be able to go forward on.
That's not just a would like, that's a we have evidence that this is going to be brought to the attention at the Commission.
If a conversation is evidence, yes.
Yeah. Dale, can I?
I agree with Jeff. I don't necessarily think that the definition will be retooled, but I think that the enforcement, that the way the definition is interpreted and applied is likely to become, to take things more seriously. Mr. Lippincott a minute ago said, you know, we educate with everything we do. Well, you can take that too seriously. That is to say, a broadcaster can claim that anything is educational for children. And so I think, for example, right now there's pending before the Federal Communications Commission a petition to deny two license renewals in the Washington, D.C. market on the basis of inadequate children's programming. I think that you know, it's too bad that it takes the commission 4 years to resolve these issues. It's, you know, a very elaborate complaint, and the petition to deny has been filed. But that's got to be addressed by the commission shortly. So under an Obama administration, a decision that might say, you know, these programs really don't count. This really isn't taking it seriously enough, could have a more profound effect on the way that the broadcast, the commercial broadcast industry, engages their obligations to children. I think that could have a more profound effect than trying to tinker with the definition.
Can I just add one thing? I don't disagree there might be a review. The one thing you want to do is to make sure that the programs are entertaining enough and educational that you get people to watch the kids to watch the shows. You could make the most educational, brilliant educational program ever, and if a child is not going to watch it, what purpose have you served? So it's a tricky balance. But there has to be an acknowledgement that the show that you want to have the kids watch the show.
I may add to that as well. Originally, we talk about the three-hour rule. When we were advocating around this, it was actually the five-hour rule that we were pushing for at the time. But we heard a lot of resistance to that, saying that this children's educational programming, this broccoli television, kids really would not have any sort of tolerance for, and it would cost broadcasters advertising dollars of some sort. And so I do agree with Dennis that we do need to have great quality television, but what it points to is kind of the PBS model, is try to figure a way that we can have good creative content that promotes things such as STEM and put it into something that's more salient for child development models, as opposed to where the majority of upwards of two-thirds of the programming has fallen into, which is much more kind of socially oriented, hey, you know, I guess I learned a big lesson today sort of stuff.
There's a lot I should be following up on with this, but we do need to jump onto the to camera very quickly. We've got a slide up on camera, comments of now President Obama on the legislation. We also just heard that there is money for NIH in the stimulus bill. Will the money for NIH, having just gone through in the stimulus bill, does anyone think that will decrease the possibility of camera getting through? It's been brought up twice so far. It's made it partway through and never gotten all the way through. Will there be an inclination at this point to say, we've just had funding for NIH, take it from there, don't come back with a specific proposal? Sandy?
The origination of CAMRA came out of Senators Lieberman and Brownback in terms of a joint effort. It actually came about as a summit hosted by Amy Jordan that then followed along, and then it came to fruition, although it's never made it through both houses. There's a real problem with getting it to NIH. There's blockage in some areas to have that be it's seen as somewhat of an earmark. With NIH having new monies, perhaps they would be funding in that area. But my understanding from talking to staffers is that it's far more likely, at least at the Senate version, to go to the Centers for Disease Control. It doesn't mean that NIH wouldn't be funding money, or maybe they would take a second look at it. But it's my understanding that that's an easier way to get it to move through the system. The other thing that they will probably do to it is send it through without any money attached to it. Originally, it had a lot of resources year by year. And to get it through the first time, what they did was that they stripped out the dollar signs. So my guess is it will go to CDC and won't have a budget attached to it.
So the effect of that will just be to say, we value this, we see importance in this, and we would like you to make it
send
a priority.
Send it to the CDC. And, you know, and I'm not sure about the House, which we've always had. I have sitting here Colin, who was going to probably tell me it depends. But you know, Representative Markey has always spearheaded children's media, and he is the major person in the House who is behind camera, so I'm sure he could shed light on that.
I think what happens will be driven by the budget process and by the appropriations process. So I think you heard again last night the president indicate a desire not to have earmarks riddling appropriation bills and budget spending bills. And so to the extent to which the definition of an earmark looks like it captures something like this, then what you might find is a more traditional separation of authorization language and appropriations language, where the authorization goes through cleanly with such sums as may be necessary type language, and then the appropriators give a lump sum of money to the appropriate agency to implement that which Congress has indicated is a priority, and then it's up to that agency to figure out how to allocate its resources internally if it doesn't have more specific didactic spending instructions from the appropriators.
And running out of time, but just one last very quick question. We have a new opportunity for a new kind of bully pulpit in the White House now. We've got a president with young children. We've got who are clearly media interested, media savvy. Does anyone foresee that we might have opportunities to do some, video game festivals in the White House, debuting the new fall season of
Great Children's idea. I think we're done for the day, everybody. Thanks so much.
Are there new ways to use that pulpit toward accentuating the positive? Anyone?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned before, I'd love to see us return to what the Clinton-Gore administration did and have annual White House summits. And it could be on online safety, or it could be on the whole range of the media issues that we're talking about. I'd love to see a 30-second piece of video watching Michelle Obama set the parental controls on the computers in the White House for her two kids as a classic example. And I think, quite frankly, they do get that. And they do get that they are examples to parents all over the country. So, yes, very much so.
So she's just setting the controls for the kids, not for Rahm Emanuel. Sorry. I said that, yes. I really apologize for not being able to get to your questions on this topic, because I know from talking to some of you, you have things that you really would like to know about. But we do need to move on to the third section of our roundtable. That's considering commercialism, and it's going to cover perhaps the most challenging issues concerning children and media, fostering an environment across media platforms that respects children's abilities and vulnerabilities when it comes to commercial messages, but that's also sustainable financially for the kind of content that we want for kids. Patty Miller of Sesame, there you are. Patty Miller of Sesame Workshop is going to present the framing.
Thank you. As we consider commercialism this morning, I wanted to give a brief overview of four main issues for the panel to consider: food advertising, interactive advertising, embedded advertising, and online advertising. We could probably spend the whole overview just talking about food advertising, since, as you know, it's been a major focus of discussion in the kids' media field over the last couple of years. So what I thought I'd do is just give a status update on what's happened in the last year on that issue, and then move to the other ones. In July, as many of you know, the FTC issued a report to Congress on food advertising and marketing to children. The report found that food and beverage advertisers spend about $1.6 billion each year marketing their products to children. The FTC had several recommendations for the industry to consider. They wanted some meaningful nutrition-based standards for marketing their products to kids. They wanted the industry to consider improving the nutritional criteria of what's known as better-for-you foods. They asked that media companies restrict the licensing of their characters to healthier products, and that they limit ads on child-directed programs to those that promote healthier foods and beverages. Also this fall, the joint FCC-Senate Task Force on Media and Childhood Obesity came to a close. Issues that remained unresolved among industry representatives and children's and public health advocates included two main things. One was a uniform nutrition standard for food marketing to children, and the role of children's media companies as gatekeepers in monitoring the food advertising environment on their channels and networks. In September, there was also a Senate hearing on childhood obesity and marketing, and the hearing focused a great deal of attention on the efficacy and status of the voluntary industry pledges, and also the possibility of a uniform nutrition standard for food marketing. Most recently, as of last month, all 15 companies participating in the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative, which is the self-regulatory initiative, the CBBB, they all implemented their voluntary pledges. So as of last month, all the pledges of the companies who've committed to be part of the CBBB initiative are in effect. And then next fall, Dale Kunkel, along with Children Now, will be conducting a study that examines the effectiveness of the industry voluntary pledges in reducing unhealthy food marketing to kids. There are some key players on this issue. Senator Sam Brownback and Senator Tom Harkin both chaired the FCC Task Force on Childhood Obesity. They also both hosted the hearing this fall. Congressman Ed Markey has been a prominent figure on this issue for some time. And then Michael Copps, the acting FCC chairman, also was part of the Childhood Obesity Task Force. Moving on to interactive advertising, in September 2004, in a unanimous FCC rulemaking, the Commission tentatively concluded that interactive click-through advertising on television should be prohibited in children's programming. There hasn't been any movement in the FCC on that front since then, but key players on this have been Commissioner, or now Chairman, Michael Copps, and Commissioner Adelstein, who've been very active on this issue, and Senator Jay Rockefeller has also expressed a lot of interest in this issue as well. Moving on to embedded advertising, and just to be clear about it, the FCC defines embedded advertising as both product placement and product integration in the actual program. Last June, the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking on this topic, and specifically what they wanted to know was whether or not the current advertising rules under the Children's Television Act addressed issues related to embedded advertising. The Children's Media Policy Coalition filed comments that saying, yes, under the CTA, they felt that embedded advertising was already prohibited and that the FCC just needed to make that fact explicit. The Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood also weighed in with the same conclusion, but also asked the Commission to consider regulating primetime when it came to embedded advertising because they felt so many kids were in the primetime audience. Reply comments were just due at the end of November, and the Commission hasn't taken any further action on this issue at this time. The last area I wanted to cover was online advertising, and two main areas in that topic, behavioral advertising, and then some of the newer media marketing techniques that we should talk about today on the panel. When it comes to behavioral advertising, and again, just sort of the definition, just so we're all on the same page about this, this is when an individual's web behavior or their online preferences is then used to send them further advertising and marketing messages. Last spring, the FTC proposed some self-regulatory guidelines and asked for public comment on the guidelines they had proposed. Children's groups, public interest groups, and the public health community all weighed in on this issue. And they asked that children's activities online should be afforded, they asked that they be given special consideration and protection, arguing that kids are unable to give meaningful consent to data collection. And specifically what the groups asked for was that data collected about the online activities of kids, people under the age of 18, be prohibited for behavioral advertising purposes. They also asked that COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act, be revised and expanded to require that parents give affirmative express consent when advertisers collect information that will be then used for behavioral advertising purposes. Just a couple weeks ago, after considering all the public comments, the FTC did come out with its report, and it did include some principles for self-regulation. The principles, though, did not define children and are not explicit about the guidelines for children. So there's been some interesting kind of rumors about what may happen next. Interestingly, Congressman Boucher has expressed a lot of interest in this issue, is not so sure that self-regulation will be enough, although he hasn't specifically weighed in on the kids front, just more broadly about the issue of self-regulation and whether or not that's enough. There's been some talk about whether or not he and Congressman Cliff Stearns might introduce some legislation. Congressman Ed Markey has been very vocal on this issue as well, as has FTC Commissioner John Leibovitz, who is a proponent of self-regulation but is concerned specifically about the child audience. And then finally, just on the new media marketing techniques, there's not a lot going on the policy front in this arena, but I just thought it would be important to talk about that we know kids are spending so much time online, and that some of these newer marketing techniques, viral marketing, sweepstakes, advert games, online TV ads, are really becoming a prominent part of the media landscape for young people today. Unlike television, this is a largely unregulated terrain, and I think it's just interesting. It would be good for the panel to weigh in on what they think may happen in this arena as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. Okay, I'm going to start with food advertising. This is an area where there's been a lot of inquiry from the Hill, a lot of inquiry from other government agencies, a lot of voluntary industry action. Jeff McIntyre, where do you see this issue going next? I know it depends, but...
What a horribly vague question. I'm tempted to say it's going, you know, that it is not losing momentum by any way. The exact place that it ends up next, I think, is open to some amount of variables. Based on the FCC task force, there was a lot of discussion on how the industry could better engage unhealthy, quote-unquote unhealthy food advertising directed towards kids. I think that we may have a little bit of a pause just because of the Children Now study that's going to be due for the end towards the end of this year. We'll get a better feel of those pledges if that pledge program has accurately done what it has proposed to do, which is to reduce the amount of unhealthy food advertising. Now, that's a distinction to us of whether the program is functioning as it says it will function, which is to better... To increase better for you foods. We
right.
don't necessarily see that as being the same thing as healthy foods.
Okay, well, you know, in response to the little online inquiry that we did with the audience asking you to make some predictions about some of these issues, more than 70% of you said that the food advertising issue was going to increase in prominence over the next couple of years. The majority think that Congress will act on this issue, and only 5% of you say that there's going to be no policy changes on the food advertising issue in the next 2 years. Dale Kunkel, do you feel like it is a reasonable likelihood that Congress would do something like the ban that they have in the UK, or do you foresee legislative action?
Well, I'll use Colin's line, and that's it depends, but I concur with Jeff's analysis. I would just structure it a little. Stage one was defining we have a problem, and everybody agrees we have a problem. Stage two was the industry has an opportunity to act. No one wants the government to step in if industry can resolve these issues satisfactorily on their own. And so we've gone through stage two. And stage three now, or act three, if you will, would be holding the industry accountable for compliance with their self-regulatory pledges. I've got to add one critical element that I think is very important to appreciate here. You could, at one level, analyze, well, is the industry doing what they said they would do? And that would be wonderful if they are, because that's a step in the right direction. But I really think there's a second key element in holding the industry accountable for their self-regulatory efforts, and that is, are they really improving the nutritional quality of food marketed to children such that healthy foods are predominating? That's where we've got to go. We can't just be focused on reducing the unhealthful foods, the ingredients that make foods unhealthful. We reduce them a little bit, and under some of the industry self-regulatory guidelines, they call that better for you. That doesn't necessarily mean those foods are good for you.
Okay.
And so I think there's got to be an evaluation of how well they're advertising foods that are good for you for children. And if they're not, I think the regulation is realistic.
Well, okay. Well, another venue for possible policy action in this front is the Federal Communications Commission. And, Colin, your boss sent a letter to the FCC a while ago saying he felt like the FCC had authority to take some action with regard to food advertising to kids. Can you tell us briefly how you think that is possible?
Well,
what you think their authority is?
The commission clearly has authority under the Children's Television Act to regulate advertising on children's television with respect to the numerical limits that children are exposed to. The statute also indicates that the commission has authority to adjust those numerical limits based upon the public interest. So if the commission wanted to exercise that authority because the public interest compelled a diminution in the overall amount of minutes that children were exposed to because some of the commercial minutes that were airing on children's television were contrary to the public interest. It could use the hammer of limiting the advertising and the advertising revenue on children's television in order to make sure that children were not exposed to problematic food marketing. Ideally, it would not come to that. Ideally, what would happen is what you might, and I don't think you will see Congress get into the regulation or Congress look at food advertising from a content-based standpoint. But I think you might see Congress try to assist the industry by pushing and trying to get something which I think would be really helpful, which is some uniform nutritional standard by which industry advertising could be assessed. Mm-hmm. And right now that is a missing, I hate to use the word ingredient, but that is a missing policy ingredient to making the rest of the policy work, is to have some benchmark by which the industry itself can know whether or not this is something that's appropriate for a children's television designated educational show or not.
Okay, I want to talk about advertising kind of more broadly, because right now we are in a recession, as everybody knows, and in recessions, regulatory policy with regard to advertising tends to historically slip, and policies with regard to advertising become more lenient. One of the things that President Obama has talked about is his experience with his kids sitting and watching sports and having advertising that he thinks is inappropriate come on. And Alan, Common Sense Media just issued a report about some of the advertising in NFL games. Tim Winter, is this an issue that is at the top of the agenda of a lot of the parents in your organization? Is that something that resonates?
Absolutely. This continues actually to be the number one issue we hear about from the public. Parents who are trying to do something responsible, watching an 8 p.m. show with their family, up comes the network promotion, even not just a product advertisement, but a network promotion with content in it that is, you know, very salacious or very inappropriate for that time period. Mm-hmm. We also see an erosion already happening in terms of standards of what a broadcaster might allow on their air in terms of content for or a product or service being advertised. For instance, during the Super Bowl broadcast, but not at the network level, but at least at the station level, mm-hmm. During the Super Bowl broadcast, there was a service that bought ad time that it provides a service by which spouses can cheat on their spouse. AshleyMadison.com. It actually aired during the Super Bowl in certain markets around the country.
Yeah.
And so I think you see the economic pressures facing TV stations. The standards are going quickly downward.
Well, Dennis Wharton, can I ask you to comment on this a little bit? The president has made a specific comment about a specific practice.
Right.
What do you think about the industry's the likelihood of any kind of change in policy?
Well, this is a tough issue. I think everybody who's a parent has at one moment or another been perhaps made uncomfortable by a promo or an ad. But I think generally those promos are designed through the network's standards and practices division to be targeted towards shows that are generally watched by a wide preponderance of adults and not for children. They review these shows to make sure that kids are generally not watching those shows. Now, occasionally, it's going to slip through the cracks. We're not perfect, just like media activists are not perfect. But generally, these are not targeted at children.
Alan, did you want to comment?
I'd just like to add one part of it from the report you already mentioned, and to echo what Tim was saying. We looked at the ads during pro football games. A quick summary: about 1 in 6 were what we would call inappropriate for kids. But one of the things we found most troubling is that the ads that had a significant level of sex or violence, nearly half of them were network promos, as Tim mentioned. They were promos for their own shows, and they were promos for shows that they already know should be airing at night. So they know the show is not kid appropriate, mm-hmm. but the promo for it that comes on at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon is highlighting those elements. And those are the network's own work.
Okay. I want to talk about another kind of advertising now briefly, alcohol advertising. Is David Jernigan here in the audience? Can somebody get him a microphone, please? One of the areas where we saw a little bit of change in policy recently was with the advertising of liquor ads on CBS during the Grammys. And David, can you briefly tell us about what the policy is now and where you think it might be going?
Sure. The four broadcast networks have had a voluntary ban on distilled spirits advertising. And CBS just broke that voluntary ban. They permitted Absolut Vodka to advertise on the Grammy Awards. So you had Miley Cyrus, and then you had an Absolut Vodka ad. And I'm really glad to get to speak here just because alcohol hasn't come up yet, and this is our kids' number one favorite drug. And every day, 5,000 kids under 16 start a drinking career. I also, I guess where I think that is going, it's been a lively topic of research and conversation. Folks from the Federal Trade Commission who have weighed in on that are actually here in the audience. There's a debate that is going to, I think, be useful for informing the debate over food advertising, too, which is how much of this advertising do kids actually have to see in order for adults to have a legitimate opportunity to find out about products that they'd be interested in. Mm-hmm. And the question is over what's a proportional standard. 30% is what the industry has targeted as a proportional standard. They include everybody under 21. That means 2 to 10-year-olds who drink almost none. The 20 AGs, the Institute of Medicine, have said there should be a 15% standard, and there will continue to be lively debate over that. In the omnibus appropriations bill, Congress has finally appropriated some money for the Centers for Disease Control to continue monitoring kids' exposure to alcohol advertising. And on the food side, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is funding Kelly Brownell and his colleagues to keep looking at the food issue. They're going to be looking at it generally, and I think also probably looking at disproportionate exposure to African-American and Hispanic kids of particular categories of foods of low nutritional value.
Okay.
So this whole idea of a proportional standard, is it based on, for food, 6 to 11-year-olds? For alcohol, you know, 2 to 20, 10 to 20? I think that's going to be a lively policy issue. The FTC has been the main player here. The FCC has not weighed in at all. And on the FTC side, Pam Harbor did issue a dissent to the FTC's most recent report on alcohol advertising in kids, where she said the standard should move at least down to 25%. As people probably know, she and John Leibowitz are the two leading candidates to be the next chairman of the commission.
Jill Luckett, do you foresee any kind of shift in the industry's approach on alcohol advertising, either tightening or loosening of the standards?
Well, I think you've seen some shift, not just recently. I think that this is an area where, you know, companies have had a variety of policies on alcohol advertising. I'm convinced that they remain committed to ensuring that those ads are appropriately placed. The self-regulatory program that was just discussed are programs that are put in place by the alcohol industry itself, the Beer Institute, Discus, Wine Institute. And so this is an evolving area across the board, not just alcohol. Companies review their advertising policies on a regular basis, but I believe that they are committed to making sure that ads are as appropriately placed as possible. And the shows that we're talking about, sports, Grammys, those kinds of shows, as Dennis suggested, are difficult examples because the vast majority of the viewing audience is adult, but families do watch that programming together. We've all had those experiences, mm-hmm. and it's something we should keep talking about. Dennis?
I just want to jump in on this one because my understanding is it wasn't the CBS network. It was local stations had the option of running the hard liquor ad that you referenced. It's left up to the local broadcaster to decide whether they want to run the show, if it's appropriate for their audience. My understanding, it was after 10 o'clock. The reality is that, not to pick on Jill, but the cable folks have been running hard liquor ads for a while. Broadcasters have not. NPR has run hard liquor ads. I've heard in the interstitials for Grand Marnier and other are hard liquor ads. So I just want to throw that out. They're always referenced to drinking responsibly, whether that buys us any goodwill or not, I don't know. But I'll just throw all those out.
All right, let's talk real briefly about positive possibilities of advertising. Can you go to two quotes ahead? And one of the things that then-Senator Obama said was that the FCC needs to make sure that broadcasters have a concrete obligation to provide public service announcements at times when people actually see them. If they do not do this, Congress should. Mary Beth Murphy, I want to ask you a little bit about public interest obligations and rulemaking at the commission on this. What is the status of any activity there? I think you still have an open rule on public interest obligations. Do you foresee anything happening in response to the president's interest on this?
I can definitely foresee something happening on it, certainly on public interest issues generally. The Chairman Copps is very committed to that, very interested, and I fully expect the new leadership at the commission to be very committed to that. We don't have anything pending on requiring PSAs. We did adopt rules a couple of years ago that require stations to inform the public about what PSAs they're running. Those aren't in effect yet, unfortunately, but hopefully they will be soon. And we can address the requirement in another context.
My recollection is that Julius Genachowski was on the staff of the commission that came up with the recommendation, the Gore Commission, many years ago, that broadcasters be required to provide a minute, an hour, I think it was. And given that and his potential to be chair and the fact that this is something that Senator Obama spoke out on specifically, I'm wondering, do you think this is an issue that may be moving forward?
I guess if you've been watching TV in the last year and you haven't seen a public service announcement for the digital television transition, then you've been living in a cave. But we've actually done studies on PSAs and found that broadcasters are the number one provider of public service. I mean, you've talked to Peggy Conlon at the Advertising Council, and she's always lauding broadcasters for PSAs. And I know the perception is that we're doing it only between the hours of 12 midnight and 6 a.m., but the reality is they're fairly well balanced throughout the day part. And the value of the PSA time is in the billions of dollars. So I know there's a perception that we're not doing public service announcements, but I think if you get into the local markets, they're doing PSAs for local charities, fundraising drives for Habitat for Humanity, Toys for Tots. So I think we do a pretty darn good job on the PSA front.
So do you think your organization would support or oppose putting sort of making it a concrete obligation?
You know, there you get into sort of the, I know voluntary sort of means has a different connotation in Washington than it does everywhere else.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we'd have trouble with a government-dictated rule.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about some of these new media marketing techniques that Patty mentioned. And I'm thinking at the time that the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative was put together, I'm looking at Elaine Kolish, KRU was also at that same time kind of expanding or enhancing their guidelines with regard to online advertising. But those changes that they made did not, to my knowledge, affect issues like viral marketing or push marketing to kids, where kids under 13 are sign up for memberships and then get sent emails. Do you guys anticipate, if I can ask you to comment from the floor, do any of you anticipate any further KRU action with regard to specifying techniques that can or can't be used in the online environment for advertising to kids, like viral marketing or push marketing?
I'm not sure KRU is going to have any specific guidance in the near future on those, but the Food and Beverage Initiative itself does cover digital marketing. Company-owned websites, which would include the send-a-friend features, are all covered by the company's pledges. So if they are using those features and they're using advert games, if they include food, it's supposed to be the better-for-you or healthier food products that they show. So
okay.
A lot of this is already being covered.
I want to open it up to questions from the audience on, preferably on the topics of advertising and commercialism, but if you have questions on any other topics for the panelists, yes.
Thank you.
Hi. Again, congratulations to the panel and the sponsors on a great program. I'm Rosemary Chalk from the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine. And we've done three reports over the last 10 years that touch on different aspects of what's been addressed here. The oldest one is youth pornography and the Internet. We did another report that two of the panelists, Dale and Sandra, were involved with on food marketing to children and youth, and then one on reducing underage drinking. I think the frontier area that I would invite some of the panelists to focus on is this concept about developing advertising or program content focused on healthy development. I heard the comments that the pro-social programs or advertisements really don't fit into the traditional E&I definitions. But this concept of healthy development is one that's really emerging from a science base, is really crucial to the positive outcomes for children and youth today. And I just wonder where the industry may be going in terms of either programming in that area or government subsidies for programs in translating the research that's emerging around what we know contributes to healthy development, how we get that into the media.
Who wants to take that? Sandy?
I couldn't speak for what the industry is committed to doing, but I can speak to the value of pro-social programming. In our study of EI programs, one of the main things kids were watching were pro-social shows, and we got a lot of information about what they were learning and concluded that it was pretty valuable. They learned to be honest, the value of friendship, you know, a lot of these pro-social qualities. And by law, pro-social is part of what EI means. And it's not the strict cognitive. I've seen some great programs that integrate both of those, but I agree with you that the pro-social programs do have value. Some of them are very sloppy. Some of them are very well done, and I think that that's an industry question about which ones they can really going to do a job versus try to slide by on.
I think we have a question here.
Harold Moss with Open Earth Media, and I wanted to inject a question based on a literacy that hasn't been addressed yet today, which is eco-literacy, which I think when we look at questions of children's health, how our food is made, what they're eating, when we look at, of course, the health of the entire ecosystem that they're inheriting from us and need to fix, and also the initiatives around clean technology and green jobs that are coming in with the new administration, I think that this is something that needs to be integrated into all of our conversations about children's media as well. What we're actually doing is a new initiative to not be dependent on commercial funding, but to leverage the thousands of organizations, environmental organizations that exist to fund, distribute, and get used in classrooms and informal educational settings, not just media, but connecting that with curriculum and getting that used into programs. And I'd like to throw that up to the panel, how people see this moving forward in the new administration, also in the context of the No Child Left Inside coalition, which already had an act passed once in the House, and is expected to be coming back this year to require eco-literacy as a mandated literacy in K through 12 coming forward, and how any of the panelists that would like to take that up see that impacting the children's media world.
Jill, do you want to talk at all about cable in the classroom and what's been done on some of these topics?
Well, I think as a general matter, you know, we're always looking for the next topic that we need to focus on, and Cable in the Classroom has a strong background in promoting media literacy, and maybe this is another topic where that's an organization that also is trying to evolve with from when teachers don't like TVs in the classroom anymore to the whole broadband experience. So I think that's it's another topic that we should certainly look at.
Is there anybody else who wanted to comment on that? Rob?
Say, you know, we've got PSAs for eco issues. So see me afterwards, and I can maybe connect you with somebody at NAB who runs our sort of PSA program.
I do think there's a broader issue of the television is literally being reinvented. In other words, the idea of what 10 p.m. means is no longer as relevant because the schedule doesn't have the same kind of primacy. One of the things we've been experimenting with is something called PBS Kids Go, which is literally a broadband channel. and kids right from the first day that it was available. I mean, every week since September, kids have downloaded or streamed a million streams. This is kids who are 6 to 8 years old.
Yeah.
And they're watching television that's on television, but they're also watching television that's no longer on television. They're playing with the characters who are in the programs in online games, and I think they think they're watching television.
What do you think are the policy-related implications of that?
I think that this means that there's a different kind of bandwidth in the sense that many people come to PBS and say, please put our program, our cause, our kind of 30-minute PSA on your because you reach 99% of the population. And, of course, we can't, or in many, many cases we cannot because we don't have enough time. Online, we have a new world, and I think that as long as it can conform to the kinds of principles and ideas that we're talking about, we're looking at a lot of different ways of expanding the throughput.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience? Yes, right here.
Hi, Sherry Hope Culver. I'm with the National Association for Media Literacy Education and at Temple University. So this is sort of going back earlier in the conversation where we're talking about tools that parents could use. The word tools came up quite a bit. And I think of tools as being things, like a V-chip, like a thing that somebody could hold in their hand. And I heard much less about the conversation and the reflective critical thinking that is the way people are able to take whatever skill they have and move into different environments, and particularly in educational environments, which I didn't hear talked about a lot either. So I'm wondering if there's anything or where you see this conversation happening about media literacy in classrooms, if anybody can comment on that.
As I mentioned before, but a big part of the project that we launched last year, the Common Sense Schools Project, is really a lot about that, and it started as the work that we do directly with parents, which are those same sort of background skills they need in helping kids choose what's good and helpful and stay away from what's unhelpful in the media. We don't. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of anything out there being wrong as much as parents and families making choices about what they feel is appropriate. And what we learn from that is that teachers and now students need some of those same skills. So we're trying to build more programs within schools that would give, I think, most importantly, that decision-making, that critical analysis ability to decide not just about what TV program is wrong for you, but how is media coming to you? How, right. Who authored it? What is their bias? What is their position? The part of that I think is really a growth opportunity in the Obama administration is I think if you look at the Obama campaign, you see a lot of people who really got that on a very high level. They used media in ways that no one has before, and I hope that means they see the opportunity of media as an engagement process, as a civic dialogue process, and as a just how to bring an entire society together on issues.
Okay.
That requires that level of digital literacy, and I hope that means they'll work toward it.
Sandy, did you have something to add?
Just quickly, I was also actually on the Pornography and the Internet Committee with the academies, and one of the things that we realized that was that children were going to stumble across pornographic content, sexually explicit is what we ended up calling it, and that you needed to educate the kids about how to handle it. I mean, you've got the notorious WhiteHouse.com. Some people are really just trying to get kids there. And so, you know, there was a whole thing about media literacy being one of the framing points for how one would deal with that. So I think that is an area that is ripe for further exploration.
Okay, we had a, right there, you had a question? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Edith Hamel-Kay-Potency of MamaMedia.com and WorldWideWorkshop.org. And I think the last two points are really leading us to ask some questions about participatory media and how the very savvy administration has been using it to engage the young and to really produce interactive content. And I think we didn't really talk enough about places where we can look at on every single issue today with relations to participatory media and policies that needs to be created. I also think that as we are thinking about all these very powerful tools that we need to provide parents for monitoring, I think very different kinds of thinking is going to be connected to participatory media. And finally, in the commercialization aspect, we didn't talk at all about policies that, first of all, a lot of good quality participatory content payment, we will need to figure out ways of building business models to charge for micropayments, pay-as-you-go, downloadables, and policies that related to how to reach kids with parental controls and consents on charging kids for quality content that they participate, that they publish, that they share. And I think that's a whole new area that we didn't even touch today. So
okay.
Maybe
good
next
point.
Meeting.
Can I see hands for other questions or comments from the audience? Yes, back there.
Hi, Velma LaPointe from Howard University.
Hi, Velma.
And this has been just a phenomenal panel. My comment is on the solution side, kind of K-16, where I've developed an undergraduate course called Youth and Consumer Culture, and we deal with these issues. As a matter of fact, we try to take a very holistic perspective. I'm training future teachers as well as other youth-oriented career professionals, and the course is very holistic, where I'm trying to make young people aware of these very issues, many who will go on to become parents, bringing in the whole green movement and so forth. So I think we have some real opportunities to use media, including the webcasting of this show. My class will be tuned in as soon as it's up, to use media as a way to educate people, to empower them, and to start at very young ages.
Okay. Thank you. Is there something here? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Renee Shiro O'Leary. I'm a professor at Teachers College, Columbia, and a media consultant. What I want to follow up on what Edith said about sort of the next generation of media, and in some ways, in listening to the panel, and this was wonderful, I think we've not maybe gone far enough in anticipating the rapid change. Some people in this room were at Kidscreen last week, which is more of an industry-related, not a policy-related conference on the development of new media for kids. And I went to a session on virtual worlds and also mega multiplayer games. For example, on a billboard in Times Square, there's a phone number. You call that number and you are suddenly playing a game with a million other people. Or they said that there were over 100 new virtual worlds. And if you haven't seen some of them, very many of them are very product-driven. Mm-hmm. So you go into the world, you create a new persona, you know, you have your avatar, et cetera. And I just think this raises a whole host of other issues that we need to look at from a media literacy point of view, but from a social and pro-social point of view.
Okay. Good. Can you pass the mic right in front of you? Nope, in front.
Thank you very much. This is a great panel. I'm John Lawson with Ion Media Networks. My question relates to something that Amy Jordan said and also infrastructure and advertising. Ion is a broadcast network. We have 60 stations. We're using one of our digital channels for a kids service. It's 24/7. You talk about 3 hours. We're doing 168 hours a week. It's all EI compliant. We've adopted nutritional guidelines that the chairman of the FCC called the gold standard for the industry. And the upside of advertising is that it's free, theoretically. But right now it's costing us a lot of money. Our problem is we can't get distribution. We have been unsuccessful so far in persuading our cable and satellite friends to distribute this free service. And my question is, given the investment of $2 billion in the DTV converter box program to make sure people still have free over-the-air television, and given the need for quality children's programming available to everyone, we don't have an economic model unless we get widespread distribution. What public policies are there out there available to an independent producer and broadcaster like us to sustain a 24/7 quality kids service?
Great. Dennis?
Well, since John's boss sits on my board of directors, you're going to hear me, you're not going to be surprised to hear me heartily endorse the digital multicast rule that has been sitting there waiting to be adopted for years. Jill and I obviously disagree on this one, but
I actually think, Dennis, the commission decided twice, and they decided against you.
I don't think they ever actually finally decided. This was one like...
I don't like when Mom and Dad fight in front of me.
This issue is like Lucy and Charlie Brown in the football. Every time we get this close, Lucy pulls the ball away before Charlie kicks it. So
Here's an opportunity for all of you in this room to advocate on the behalf of more educational programming on free over-the-air broadcasting. We've already got it on Fios. We've already got it on RCN. We need our cable partners, who are great friends, to help us on this one.
In other words, we're...
Cubo. And there's also a health channel they have as well, which is really good and fits in with the whole Kaiser model. Yeah.
So, in other words, looking at multicast, must carry, as in part a children's media issue because of expanding the availability.
If you get multicast carriage, you get local C-SPAN channels in every community.
We're going to give Jill a word in on this.
We've heard this argument for years, and the broadcasters in many cases still have not produced that programming. ION is maybe the exception. We do, as a cable industry, carry a lot of multicast programming. We have a voluntary agreement with the public TV stations to carry multicast programming, so it's not like this stuff isn't available over cable. But it's a commercial negotiation. These negotiations are difficult. Ask any cable programmer in the room. The cable industry, as a general matter, is going to carry programming that it believes its customers, its viewers, want to see. And, we'll keep talking to Cuba.
Okay. Colin, you wanted to comment on this?
Well, I was just going to say that the multicast must carry issue is one that my boss has actually proposed provisions on in the past, and it is one where we, in a very politically astute way, to make sure it never went anywhere, we came down in between where NAB was and where NCTA was. And what we suggested was that there ought to be multicast must carry, certainly for the public broadcasters, and we do appreciate that there's a voluntary agreement to carry those multicast channels for the public broadcasters. But in headlong pursuit of making sure that the additional beneficial content, all of those local C-SPAN productions and local news, civic information, and children's educational fair made it onto distribution platforms, we insisted that such fair be quantified and measurable and not simply a pledge. And we wanted to make sure that it was something that the cable operator knew that there was a specific governmental interest in the carriage of it because there was local civic or children's educational fair that merited the additional channels being carried, but we also wanted to make sure that we were getting what we thought we were getting with public policy by making sure that it wasn't just a promissory note, but it was measurable, quantifiable, and could be assessed then during retransmission consent negotiations or must-carry elections and also during license renewal.
Okay. We have been here almost 3 hours now. We have barely scratched the surface of a lot of the topics that we've talked about, and there's a lot of other topics that we haven't had time to get to at all yet. I think the point is there is a children's media policy agenda out there. The decisions that the policymakers who are here today, that the industry folks who are here today make on all of these issues, there will be decision points coming up. The decisions that you make will have a big impact and make a real difference for kids and families. We're in a new era. I want to thank you all for coming and especially thank our panel for taking so long to be with us here today. Thank you so much. I have a couple of students.
Yeah.